I don't know if this is of interest only to me. I think.
Uh-huh.
But this was the communication staff when we had a speechwriter, when we didn't have a speechwriter.
Actually, this would be really good. David Olson contacted us.
Well, David Olson he's dead. He got caught he was a former Channel 2 reporter. He was in a love triangle and got stabbed to death by the jealous husband.
Great.
Jim is truly my best friend, mm-hmm. other than my wife. And so we've maintained connections. And David Olson has great stories. David Olson has stories about, you know, the bet he had that he could get the governor to quote Shakespeare in a speech.
Yeah.
And David is an intellectual, just a wonderful, wonderful guy. Speech writers are very interesting. They're harder than hell to manage. And so you basically have to hire them and with the understanding that you're not going to manage them.
Yeah.
You know, they're creative, and the more creative somebody is, the more difficult it is.
Well, he tells a great story about getting hired, because he went through the process, and then you brought him in, and he was just surprised as hell that you guys called him.
Mm-hmm.
And so you took him in to meet Jerry, and Jerry just scared the hell out of him. And then when I talked to Jerry about it, he said, "I can't believe that. Like, Jerry, you're intimidating. You know you're intimidating." Mm-hmm. And then when you took him in to meet the governor, both mm-hmm. of you took him in to meet the governor. Mm-hmm. The governor has got a stack of stuff, and you know he's smoking. He kind of said, "What's this?" And he said, "I have the exact line in here, but it's something like, I have no objections." He walking out, David said, "You turned to him and said, I don't know if you caught that, but that was a job offer."
Well, you know, we were early on. We didn't have a speechwriter.
Yeah.
And in fact, Lee, as you've heard me already tell the story many times, was really unhappy that I had been hired well before he came on board, and was trying to get Gene Modlin involved.
Mm-hmm.
And then Bill Sanderson was a possibility. And I don't know if you know who Bill is, or was. I don't even know if Bill's around anymore. Again, two very talented people, but it was all more of an effort to bring in people that were loyal to Lee, not necessarily to me.
Right.
Well, Sandy was going to be the guy who we were going to hire pretty much, and because he'd written some speeches for us before he was involved in the inaugural speech, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote this two-page single-space list of demands that were all, by the way, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a self-correcting typewriter, an office that the door closes, access to a secretary. Mm-hmm. It was the stuff that he would have gotten without a problem.
Yeah.
All he had to do was say, you know, can I get this kind of thing? And we would have given it to him. But he wrote it in such a style of, you know, these are my demands, and if I don't get these, I'm not going to even look at this job kind of thing. And so I'm sitting in the boss's office, and he says, "Well, what do you think about Sanderson?" And I said, "Well, you know, he's got an immense talent. He's incredibly creative. I think he'd be a great speechwriter. I don't think he would fit into this office. I don't think his style of making these kind of demands," he said, "these are all things he would have gotten had he simply accepted the job and said, can I get this, can I get that? We would have fallen over. But that kind of attitude is not going to fit in with the team approach that we've got here." And he didn't get hired as a result of that.
So. Yeah.
But yeah, the more creative someone is, the more difficult they are in terms of...
Let me take a picture of this.
Oh, okay.
Just so I have...
I could actually print one off.
Oh,
probably.
No, it's okay. I have this technology. Let's use it.
Well, here's a check, a bill from the San Antonio Hyatt Regency from the Alamo Bowl days. It's amazing how papers get...
That's great.
And I had multiple copies of this, and so I just pulled one out before I gave it over to Ava. That was the, you know, stick with the talking points. This is our message for the in the campaign. Things you're already aware of, Jim.
This is 1982.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. That he began his elective service as in the House of Representatives on January 12th of 1959, and he ended it on January 12th, 1987, to the day exactly 28 years.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a bit of that he became governor at 11:42 a.m. on January 8th, 1979, and 8 years and 4 days later at 11:56, Neil Goldschmidt, or the person who succeeded him in office,
right.
Took his oath of office. So, you know, the recording of all that, and of course that's why his exact time of death is also recorded,
right.
Because that's just the way he was,
thing. Exactly.
Okay, now again, A, B, or C, or
okay.
yes, no, or whatever.
Okay.
For example, you already know and have a copy of the administrative note on Inauguration Day, the purpose of the administration.
Right.
Hire good people, give them direction, get out of their way. I'd rather have to sit on them once in a while than have to kick them in the tail every day to get them started.
Right.
Okay. Up a creek without a paddle award, certainly.
Yes.
And do you have all the stories connected with each of the awards?
That I don't think that we do. There's a new exhibit about...
Oh, really?
It's now out.
Oh, really?
And we actually heard from Tom yesterday that the guide on that trip is still kind of miffed that the paddle didn't come back to him.
Oh, that's interesting.
So,
I hadn't heard that one.
Exactly.
Well, the two that immediately come to my mind, John Williams got it when he lost the governor. He said, I want to find out what this security thing is all about.
Uh-huh.
So Lon, take a day off. I'm going to be Lon.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be a security guy. Well, you develop, as a staff person, you develop this incredible ability to keep, you always mm-hmm. know where he is.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's like a mm-hmm. radar GPS tracking system or something like that. And John didn't have that.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, governor's gone. He doesn't have him in sight. And so he got that. Public Utility Commissioner...
Lobdell?
Yeah, John Lobdell. I think okay. it was, or oh, come on, it was another name on the paddle. Names are always flopping out of my mind. But anyway, he's the one who was testifying, and they were just harassing the hell out of him during some testimony.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, look, my job is tough enough, and I don't have to take this shit. On the record, almost as good as Sheila in the Rajneesh.
Yeah.
I'm going to fuck you off. I'm going to do this, you know.
Yeah.
So those were two. And then we had to make sure, of course, that the governor was the last. So we cooked up a whole bunch of mm-hmm. things on that. Okay. The belief in volunteerism and the story of probably digging an outhouse at Camp Merriweather.
I have not heard that one.
Okay. So I'll give you that one on tape if you like. They'll say nice things about me when I'm gone. I actually said that at the service.
Mm-hmm.
Placing his own calls where he would, instead of saying, this is Governor Atiyah, I'd like to mm-hmm. talk to Leo Hegstrom.
He'd just call Leo.
He would call the number and he would say, Leo Hegstrom, please. And of course, agency head palace guards said, I'm sorry, Mr. Hegstrom is unavailable right now. May I take a message? Yeah, have him call the governor. Just a minute.
Great.
Yeah, I get it.
That goes really well. When I talked to John Yunker, he went to the archives because Victor would answer those letters mm-hmm. in person.
Right.
And so John just pulled out several letters that he had worked on with Vic, and Vic wrote the final version and packed up. And it's so the same kind of thing. It's great.
Well, and then the what goes with that is the answering calls on a holiday.
Uh-huh.
Have you heard that story?
No.
Okay. These are ones I really want to make sure you have. You may have not have room for any of them, but you need to have them,
mm-hmm.
and they need to be recorded on something.
Mm-hmm.
One day you're a peacock, the next day you're a feather dust.
Yep,
okay. Ate a lot of meals at the Capitol Coffee Shop. The come on down story I told at the thing.
Mm-hmm.
He took a taxi to White House events.
Yes.
Other people literally took their... You know, their limos.
Some had their limos flown in.
Yes, yes. And we took a taxi, but you know about Mr. Kim?
Mr. Kim, I know. No.
Okay, Mr. Kim.
Kind of familiar, but I've talked
to Mr. Kim was the driver for Vice President Bush, H.W. Bush.
Okay.
While a smoker, he was not a drinker. And you know the story about where he says he had his own anti-drinking program because he went with a bunch of lobbyists.
Yes,
and they got drunk
about three different ways.
Right. Yeah. Depending on whether Roger Martin tells you or whether the governor tells you,
exactly,
or it comes out a little bit different.
And I also have from Ed when Victor decided not to drink gin anymore.
Okay,
that was college.
That's good. That's good. And I can't tell you exactly when he quit smoking, but he did quit after he got out of the governor's office.
Yeah.
And he said he was going to, and he did. Mm-hmm. And he said, I didn't quit. I just didn't have a cigarette. And then I didn't have another cigarette. And then I didn't have another cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't like any special program and patches and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they hated drunk drivers, and so they would actually pull drunk drivers over until John Williams said, no, you will. You have a radio. We gave you a radio. You will do that. You've heard that story.
Yes.
Okay. Artistic school, doodler, you know that.
Mm-hmm.
Green Bay Packers,
mm-hmm.
Massive file of favorite jokes. I do have a copy of that file, by the way.
Good, because I don't know that Tom has given it to us when it was, the government was very clear that that was going to come to us. But he's gone now, so if things aren't in specific writing, that's just the way it is.
Unsigned executive orders. Baker City Tie Tack. You know that Jem is in Baker City and he's wearing a Tie Tack in zillions of pictures.
Yes, and I actually contacted Jack Oman because he used it in his caricatures.
Yep.
But Oman said, you know, I've got 4,000 cartoons all over the place.
Right.
So I might try to dig it up from a specific editorial cartoon and then say, Oman, do you have this?
Yeah, Jack should. Jackson should have told you in his Kennedy accent, his great
yes.
Kennedy imitation.
Yes.
He and I were at a party at Wayne Thompson's house one time. We both have an affinity toward Stan Freberg, and especially
mm-hmm.
Stan Freberg's United States of America, the first,
mm-hmm.
the early years.
Mm-hmm.
And we were at this New Year's Eve party, and somebody said, sorry, and then I said, sorry doesn't do any good, Charlie. And he immediately started, and we started doing dialogue and songs, and people were looking at us. I mean, I've got it memorized. He has it memorized. End of story. Okay, Baker City, couldn't pronounce nuclear, lifetime fishing license, departing from his prepared text. Hey, he wanted to know how to in fact get attention to a speech he was giving,
mm-hmm.
and it was the legislative speech. It wasn't like it was a state of the state. It wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, there's a simple way. And he said, what do you mean simple way? I said, well, we just don't put it in the text. Well, if I want people to, you know, focus on it, I should put it in the text.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's just the opposite.
Exactly. They're going to read along.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, what are you going to do?
Right. He departed from his, you know, the handle it story.
Yes.
And where that came from.
Yes.
The blow up the sign certainly literally needed to be locked into a room to make fundraising calls.
Yes.
Jim Campbell always had the priority because he was usually calling in with a joke. We made do you know about the bet that he paid off with a dinner at L'Omelette?
No.
Okay. I don't need to give that on the tape, but just for your information, and we don't even remember what the bet was all about. It was
mm-hmm.
something at a governor's conference because Pat and Jerry and somebody else were all there. But it was the stakes were a dinner at L'Omelette, which
mm-hmm.
then existed at that point. And I just, you know, I got more out of that because I just kept coming after him. Oh, you know, I'm going to get my dinner at L'Omelette and so on. And he would go, yeah, okay, fine. And so on. So when we got there, they had arranged because McDonald's was just catty corner from L'Omelette at that time.
Uh-huh.
And so I ordered, you know, the most expensive thing I could possibly get and so on and so forth. And they brought in this huge silver platter with this big dome
mm-hmm.
thing on it. Oh, Mr. Miles here. And they took it off, and it was a Big Mac. Great sense of humor. The California couple that visited his office.
Yes.
Daily public open houses, media
mm-hmm.
availabilities, Capital Press Award.
Mm-hmm.
His go-to gift for charity auctions was a brown bag lunch with the governor. In other words, whenever they asked for anything, it was, okay, a brown bag
mm-hmm.
lunch with me, and it gave him a chance to meet with some people, too.
Mm-hmm.
After the 82 election, his advisors, not me, his advisors said, you don't need to do this back-breaking travel schedule any longer. You can't run another term. He said, no, you don't understand.
Mm-hmm.
I do this because I want to do it.
Yeah.
The reason he wouldn't look at congressional positions, I'm guessing, is the Middle Eastern ambassador positions would open up and the press would ask him about it, and his classic line was, you know, I'd consider that as long as my office was in Oregon.
Because
mm-hmm. he just didn't want to go to Washington, D.C. or leave Oregon.
Yep.
Quarter million miles of travel within the state. The parade in Fossil, they went around once. They had so much fun, they
right.
went around a second time.
Right.
I don't believe any governor in Oregon has a history of more in his 20 years of experience in legislatures. Have you found a governor that had more than 20 years or had 20 years?
Not yet.
Okay.
Not yet.
Well, you have blue books now up
yeah.
yin yang, and also copies of all the biographies of all the governors of the state of Oregon.
Right.
The tax plan debate with Rich Munn when Rich came back saying, yes, Governor, it turns out you're right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know that.
You don't know that? Okay, yeah. That's a good story.
That's a good one.
We have to separate the essential from the desirable. That's just one of his phrases. When the budget story, when the guy said, you know, Governor, it's only $30,000.
Yes.
Okay. And he said, well, that was in your checking account.
Exactly.
I think it was Mike Thorne's wife who was the one who told him.
Absolutely. I have that totally corroborated.
This job is tougher than you made it
look.
That's
the working title of the book.
Oh, good.
And when I talked to her, I actually played him saying it. And I said, so is that you? And she nodded. That's me.
Uh-huh. Have you had a chance to talk to Goldschmidt at all?
No.
Because he is really under the radar out there.
Kitzhaber appears to have just resurfaced in a gettable way.
Right.
So I'm expecting to be able to talk to him. Goldschmidt, I hope I can talk to him. But Who knows? I mean, I talked to Packwood. That was a hard get.
I bet.
But he wouldn't let me record. Yeah. But he gave me really good stuff.
Good.
And now it's Bob and Jim. He called me up and
said, he's pissed at
Jim,
me.
This is Bob.
He's pissed at me because of things that I've said about the Columbia Gorge.
I totally have his side of the Columbia Gorge.
Uh-huh.
That may be the next thing that I work on. It won't be until May because I basically have one day a week to work on the book.
Okay. Well, talk to Jerry about the hot tub. Next, that on your list of questions because... Okay. You know, he was unavailable because he was in the spa.
Yeah. Well, we heard from Tom yesterday. Tom was at the Multnomah Athletic Club, And Bob was there and then headed into the hot tub where Tom knew his wife was sitting. And Tom just basically ran after him to be there. And Leslie was saying, yes, he had no sense of personal space.
the tape really is not running, right?
It is.
That's fine.
It is.
All I will say to you then is that I personally know one of the people who he was a basher with.
When this whole thing broke, it explained behavior that I had seen when I was in fourth grade.
Yeah, yeah.
So I can name them, and I actually didn't, you know, that wasn't what our conversation was about.
Right.
But I said, so do you remember these people? Oh yeah, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
All the women were all easy on the eyes.
Yeah,
still to this day.
And the most important quote in the inaugural address, as far as I'm concerned, the plain fact is that given the light to see the truth, our people will decide their destinies better than any elite, elected or not.
Right.
That is a core value. Commitments to diversity, you've got. Sense of history, I gave you that information. And all the time specifically recorded. And the fact that 8:15 on July 20, 2014, and that was, you know, Tom and I texting each other, basically, because I was home.
Yeah.
And then you have the data that talks about the fact that the recession in 82, or 80, the 80s, if you will, was worse than for Oregon. Okay.
Yeah. That's
okay, good.
Well known. And what the graph that I'm hoping to use is actually the Oregon economic people have got a great one that compares what we just went through with that one.
Yeah.
Same exact patterns, but the 82 one is just so much deeper and longer to get out of.
Well,
so,
and it's because we were so much more dependent on timber and housing and all of that kind of stuff.
Now, doing the background for the chapter that I'm working on, I just went through 20 years of Blue Books, just reading, so what do they say about economics? How many people were in the House when he was there? How many people in the Senate? You know, all that kind of stuff. Fascinating to me is it appears that the big turn in timber was not just 82, it was 74.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, the timber proportion of the manufacturing goes from like 57% by the late 70s. By the time he's in office, it's in the upper 30s. So that oil crisis slowdown is a huge hit.
Now,
and then the 82 recession is like the nail in the coffin.
Is that board feet though, or is that?
No, this is in people who are working.
Yeah,
so it's the economic impact there, but there's automation going on.
That's what I was going to say, a lot of automation.
Yeah. So, but if you're a worker,
Whether you lost your job because we're selling less, or
so that's something I've never heard people talk about. So I'm going to really explore that.
But anyway, the key numbers were the double digit numbers that
just stayed up
at various times. Okay. Yeah. So I've got a couple marked here that I'll go in a little more detail on. I want to look real quickly at this. You've heard enough about Trader Vic and have all of his travels. You know, you have this list.
Mm-hmm. And I have Chuck Beggs claiming the Trader Vic moniker.
Was his?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe. The Bustamante list is slipped into a bunch of artists. You haven't heard that story?
No.
Okay. The GUN in the pouch.
Yes.
Okay. the huge sword that he had Lon and I ship back or bring back from Syria.
I've not heard about the sword.
Okay.
I do, however, have from Pat Amadeo the fake scrimshaw.
Yeah, I couldn't tell from the notation on the online about that gift whether she made it clear that it was fake.
Oh, I don't. Yeah.
Okay.
I'll look at that and.
Yeah, because he was taken.
I've got her quotes, and so I can just put them, have them up there.
The leaks and how the governor and I approached dealing with leaks.
You've given me some details, but I want more.
Okay. Sleek black limo, which was basically sleek, no. Limo, no. Black, yes. It was a black Buick Skylark.
Yes.
You got that.
I got that.
Didn't respect family privacy. They found out when one of Suzanne's weddings was, and it was probably the most pissed he was ever at any bunch of reporters.
No, I don't have that, so
okay.
That's good.
Short sleeve shirts, mm-hmm. tuxedo swimming pool. The tax revenue plan, when it was, we called another meeting with all the leadership, and we opened up the whiteboard in the conference room, and the one from the previous crisis was still up there, the solution. And unfortunately, all of those cans had been emptied, and so we couldn't do that. Have you heard that one?
No, I have not.
Okay, we'll try and make these quick, because you don't have a lot of time. But something I didn't know until after he was out of office, that he told Jerry that if we were taken hostages, we were not to be negotiated for.
I got that clearly.
Why didn't he tell me? God, I was Lon and I were there.
You were there, exactly.
Yes, right.
Exactly.
That he had to approve all the colors of any
right?
important kind of thing.
Got that.
Okay.
So when I talked to Carol Whitney,
uh-huh.
she did not encounter that in 78, but she did encounter that he gave Dolores and Suzanne free rein to do that
right.
with her.
Right.
So.
Love being governor, incredible respect for the position, long hours, weekends, legislature, long-term relationship with the tribes, you've got all of that.
Do you happen to know when his relationship with the tribes started?
In the legislature, and he was, I believe, he said he was, the person that created the Indian Commission.
He absolutely did. I'm trying to get, so why?
Okay.
And so, hypothesis, Sam Johnson.
Hmm. Yeah. They were close.
They were close. Cause
have you talked to Becky at all?
No, I've got to track her down. She's now on her board, actually.
Okay.
I got to track her down, and I'm not sure she would know. But there's something happened. 71 is when the commission is formed.
Okay. Donna Zajong was Sam's legislative assistant.
Ew.
So
okay.
That's a possible connection.
That's a good way to go too.
So.
Okay. Good.
Almost done here. Affirmative action. Not a food gourmet.
Yes.
Bacon. Bacon, basted eggs, hash browns, and toast and coffee.
Yeah.
Whether you're at the Imperial Hotel in Tokyo, whether you're in Beijing,
right.
The job was to find a place that had that.
And frustrating for Dolores, who liked to cook gourmet stuff, and he wouldn't eat it.
Collecting autographs for Ruby Lewis?
Heard obliquely, but yeah, fill that in.
Okay, well, I'll put it all in one spot. Artistic abilities, doodles, volunteerism, the Camp Meriwether thing we're going to use. he bought into this. It wasn't something I taught him, but that governor's a title you don't lose. It's like being a colonel in the South.
Right.
The story that for me was in 77, I said, so is it Vic or is it Victor? And he said, my name is Victor. Mm-hmm. And then I said, well, okay, but you realize that Vic is much better for political purposes. It's more approachable and less. He said, yeah, I know. But he said, my really good friends call me Victor. And of course, Paul always calls him Victor. Mm-hmm. Victor did this and Victor did that. So.
Bob Oliver said that you use it in the office to kind of filter through.
Yeah.
That people call in and say, I need to talk to my good friend Vic.
Yeah.
You're not.
Yeah, it's like Bud Gibbs, the registrar at Oregon State, they went to talk to their good friend. What was his real name? It was, and it wasn't Bud.
Mm-hmm.
I never called him Vic or Victor.
Mm-hmm.
He was either governor or the boss.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Since you, I'm having whenever I see Kate Brown, which isn't that often anymore, but she's the governor.
Right.
You know, she's not Kate. Although the first time I saw her was in a very public place, and she came almost running over and jumped up and kissed me on the cheek. It's like, you're the governor.
I don't understand that. I mean, it's like, and when any governor walks in the room, I stand.
Yeah.
I mean, I just, and the governor finally, our governor finally just said, no, please don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
The dedication of the old Wolf Creek Tavern.
Yes.
You got that story?
Were you on that trip?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I would like to hear yours, because I have it from, Ding Dong in Roseburg. Bill Markham.
Bill Markham.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Bill was an important part about that.
Yeah.
Lon Holbrook telling the pilot that the Salishan Airport was right there.
I don't have that.
Okay. joke biology.
Yeah, the best Bill Markham line in that particular story is, it was raining harder than a cow peeing on a flat rock.
True. Tex Shively carrying a long gun during the 1977 session, right in the front door, and just bringing it up to show.
I don't have that. So, yeah, okay.
Okay, well, let's just get started. I'll try to roll through these pretty quickly.
Okay,
all right. And I'll go with this list first because I circled the ones. You see how organized I am.
Uh-huh.
Ruby Lewis was one of the three people who was there on day one and on the last day. Now, I was on vacation. I was in Lincoln, Nebraska on that mm-hmm. day, but I was on the payroll that mm-hmm. day. And Bob Oliver and Ruby were mm-hmm. the three that were there from the very beginning to the very end. And she's now living, I think, up in Longview someplace, that general area. Mm-hmm. And she was an autograph collector. So he was constantly collecting autographs mm-hmm. for her mm-hmm. and then deliver famous people kind of thing. And
yeah.
I don't know which one she has now. And I don't know whether she and or her heirs would be willing to pass them on to the university or not.
Yeah.
But it was a big part of his activity in meeting people. So we were in a National Guard helicopter, and in those days, you had to have some military action or activity involved. So there was always maybe a stop in Eugene or something mm-hmm. to take a quick look at an armory. Okay, now we can get back in the helicopter. So mm-hmm. we're in a three helicopter flight,
mm-hmm.
and we are going over each little pass down into Southern Oregon to get to the Wolf Creek Tavern to dedicate mm-hmm. it, and in the process of that, the ceiling just kept coming down. I don't know that it was peeing like a cow on a flat rock or not.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to the last one, and they kind of come up to it. So remember, I'm a pilot,
mm-hmm.
and so I know that this is not a fun situation to be mm-hmm. in. And so we got the inner phones on and so on, and the pilot says, Governor, I don't know that. I just took a second look at that pass, but I just don't know if that's one we want to try. What do you think? And the governor says, you got all the bars on your shoulder kind of thing. And so then Markham says, you know, right down here, because, of course, he's from Riddle, and I believe the town is Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, let's go down this other canyon, and we'll land at the school. So you got to remember, you're at the school yard, and all of a sudden, three National Guard helicopters, without any notice. I mean, it's a scene out of Apocalypse Now. And the kids come out, and their eyes are as bad. So I go with Bill. We're walking up and walking away to get a bus. And the superintendent is coming down the hill. And the superintendent says, God damn it, Bill, what the hell are you doing landing in the middle of my... And we're walking with him back up to get a bus, and Bill finally says, look, I've got the governor with me. And the superintendent wheels, literally, just, and left us to go down just to talk to the governor, obviously. And so Bill and I go up to arrange for a school bus. So we get down there, and here are this crowd of kids are around, and the National Guard guys have got anybody who looks like they're about 16, 17, you know, looking in the... You, too, could be flying one of these mm-hmm. helicopters. They're recruiting, mm-hmm. and people are sitting in the chairs and so on and so forth. And so we go, and we start going into classrooms while we're waiting for the bus. Mm-hmm. And in the one classroom, the governor... This is a developmentally disabled classroom, and he says to the guy, he says, what are you... And she's sanding this board. And he says... What are you making? This looks very interesting. And she says, I'm making a smooth board. Very good. That feels very nice and smooth, and so on and so forth. And then somebody in another class comes up with her peachy mm-hmm. and says, Governor Atieh, would you sign this? And of course, she's used to people wanting signatures. And he says, yeah, why would you like me to sign that? Well, if I go home tonight and tell my mommy that three helicopters landed at our school and the governor got out and came into my class and visited, she won't believe me. And if you sign this, I have a chance that she... And he said, well, I think the word will probably get out. This is not that big of a town, but I'd be delighted. What's your name? And he proceeded to sign it. So then we take the bus over the last little bit in the mm-hmm. lowest gear that school bus had mm-hmm. on the freeway, and we came down and did the dedication, and there's no press. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a dedication of a state park mm-hmm. facility kind of thing, and I'm snoozer, right? It was on the schedule, and that was about it. So I proceeded to call Sue Hill and call the wire services and tell them the same story. So it ended up, did make some mm-hmm. press, because it's obviously a cool story. And a lot of flying, of course, and that brings up the next book you should write, by the way, and I've got a file on that as well, and mm-hmm. that's the plane crash in outside of Lakeview. I'm one of the few people who knows exactly where it is because I've been there. Mm-hmm. And it took me two trips, but I found it. And
well, Earl Snell, who clearly is the most popular governor we've ever had mm-hmm. by far.
Right.
And
was going to be United States Senator. And
yeah.
And according to Travis, when that occurred, Mark Hatfield calls from Palo Alto and says, we got to move up our schedule.
Yeah. Yeah,
because he had his schedule all figured out.
They were in graduate school, and they just basically packed up and came back here.
Right, yeah. Right. So anyway, yeah, Lon knew more about where airports were than some of the volunteer pilots we mm-hmm. had at various times. And so at one point, it's bad weather, and it's Salishan, and that's a hard airport to mm-hmm. find in the first place. And the mm-hmm. guy says, I'm not totally, and Lon says, the airport is right below us now. So,
so on that,
yes.
So volunteer pilots... you're flying around the state when people are basically donating their planes for use?
In 74, before I was involved, absolutely. In 78, yes, with at least a chief pilot who was like a chief volunteer, and Carol would know more about that than I would.
Okay.
In 82, I went one step further, and that was we had a chief pilot, we had actually several chief pilots, and the pilots and the aircraft had to be approved by them before we would put the sitting governor of the state of Oregon into a
right.
volunteer airplane.
Right.
And so we had standards that were set, and Carol G., the scheduler, just knew she had a list of the approved.
Yeah.
And if somebody called up and was willing to donate, and most of these donations in 82 were twin-engine, lumber company executive, fully icing protected and all that kind of stuff. But there was a time, and the governor tells the story, he may not have told you, where in 74, I think it was, that he's flying in like a Super Cub over in Eastern Oregon, and the cars are going faster than the Super Cub is. Mm-hmm. And there's the whole thing surrounding the Governor Snell and Cornett and Farrell mm-hmm. Was legislation that then followed that they couldn't all travel together.
Right.
So we went to a land board thing in Rome, landing on a gravel strip, and Norma had to go on a different airplane at some point. And I don't know what that status is now because they've changed the whole succession and everything else since then. During the 77 session, Tex Shively course, he thought nothing of it. It was perfectly legal, mm-hmm. and it was a long gun. It wasn't mm-hmm. being concealed or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And he just walked in, and I think knowing exactly what the reaction would be. And by the time he got to the senator's desk, there were three state police officers, retired state police officers,
uh-huh.
with their, you know, slightly too big for their suits, and yeah. with a hard spot right here on their suits because they mm-hmm. had their sidearm with them, following right behind him. And he kind of grinned about it, and the senator grinned about it, but... You know, that's the only time that today, if you did that, I think they would stop you at the door, or they have ways of stopping you at the door.
Yeah.
And Tex Shively was just a fascinating guy in the first place. He was the stereotypical gun nut, even though he was not a gun nut. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't think I marked it, handle it. Answering phones. The Rich Munn story. You haven't heard this one, or you've heard part of it?
I have not heard this.
They're in a meeting, and it's about a tax plan. And it was one of those things of, you know, okay, we're going to tweak this here because we need the revenue. And mm-hmm. because he, in fact, did cut budgets and increase taxes virtually mm-hmm. every time we had... we emptied tin cans initially, and then it was a matter of doing both,
mm-hmm.
Which both were unpopular.
Mm-hmm.
And three times in 82, as you're aware. So here's the governor, who's served 20 years, I think, on the Revenue Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And here's Rich Munn, who was the revenue person for the legislature and then was the head of the Department of Revenue under ATIA for a good part of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they're having this discussion, and the room is full because it's like an important mm-hmm. kind of thing, you know. Kind mm-hmm. of, and there's no legislators there, but they're discussing what would happen if you did this and did that. And it is very esoteric.
I mean,
we are, everyone is lost. Everyone is lost except for Rich and the governor.
Uh-huh.
And Rich is going, well, no, governor, he's being so almost condescending, but he was just being so polite. Governor, no, you remember back when we changed that and that would tweak this and that would push this over here, mm-hmm. which would have the effect of causing this to modify. No, Rich, I tell you, that change doesn't do that. It does this, that, and something else. And,
mm-hmm.
and he's not wanting to, quote, win an argument because he works for the governor, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he finally says, okay, Governor, let me do this. Let's do a run tonight, which was code for we're going to work the computer people all night long and pay a mm-hmm. lot of overtime. And in those days, of course, it was, you know, IBM cards and
yeah.
spinning tapes and big green bar things. And a run came back with something about this thick because
right.
you could tell by legislative district what the impact was going to be, which was an important part of mm-hmm. of the whole revenue thing, if this was going to have a disproportionate impact on the chair of Ways and Means or the chair of the Revenue Committee, and of course they were all Democrats,
mm-hmm.
you were in big trouble. So
yeah.
you had to look at it that way. So Rich is over, and they run, and it took all night to do mm-hmm. what we could probably do on our watches today.
Right.
And which gets into that whole thing I would like to talk a little bit about, which is the milieu that we were operating under. I mean, that
mm-hmm.
people think nowadays, well, you go to the PC and you look up on the... No, this was... mainframe computers in an air-conditioned room in the old revenue office running all night long to come up with this big stack that you could then go through and circle things to see. He came back, and he was so chagrined. And Rich will tell you the story. He said, Governor, you're right. That's exactly the way it turns out when you do the computer run.
Mm-hmm.
So literally just knowing that system so well, better yeah. than Rich Munn did,
yeah.
and that the computer ends up proving him right.
Yeah.
It blew us all away.
Yeah. I find by 1963 the newspaper is the reporters are referring to him as the Republican's tax expert.
Really?
Yeah.
That's very very appropriate.
Which is exactly when he says it happened, because Clarence Barton was the main guy.
Mm-hmm.
Clarence becomes the speaker. And everybody began to look to Vic for the tax stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So it fits exactly with his remembrance.
Because he actually went to the committee meetings.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of people just didn't bother
yeah.
to go to if they were going to be an important vote, whatever.
Yeah.
But he sat there and listened to people and learned about it.
Yeah.
And I didn't know squat. I came in 77. I didn't understand what property taxes paid for and
oh, yeah.
what the property tax limitation would do and, you know, all of these kind of things. And I had to go to school on that just as a flunky.
Mm-hmm.
His story that he would tell about how important voluntarism is,
mm-hmm.
He says he's in the bottom of a hole on a rainy day digging a hole, and I think it was for an outhouse, but I don't think he ever said. Maybe it just was due, a story, but he said, and the rain and the mud is dripping down his neck, and he's digging this hole at Camp Meriwether, and his thought was, there isn't enough money in the world to pay me to do this job, and yet I'm enjoying what I'm doing here. Mm-hmm. And he said, and that is the key to volunteerism, is that you do it because it's something that makes you actually feel very good that you're making this kind of a contribution. Placing his own calls, I kind of told you that story, and that because and it happened over and over again. And he would just reach over and push a button because he didn't know the number necessarily, mm-hmm. and he would push a button, and we'd say, tell them who you are. And they'd say, you know, it's so-and-so there. And they would go through the same thing every time. Mm-hmm. We said, see? See what happens when that happens? Okay, there was this day where the state government was off in February. You know, President's mm-hmm. Days and President's Birthdays and so on and so forth. And everybody else was working. The federal government was working, mm-hmm. and schools were in session, and you could mail things, and you had to pay at the parking meter, but state government had a holiday, okay? So the office is empty except for the boss and me. And I'm far enough away that normally I wouldn't hear things going on. But in this case, it was dead quiet, and we were both catching up more than anything else. Mm-hmm. And the phone at the front desk is ringing off the hook. Ring, ring, ring. And we didn't have voicemail or anything like that. It was none of that kind of stuff. It was a big button phone with a cord this big running to it. And he finally came down. And he says, is there any way we can deal with that phone out there? And I said, I don't think so. I don't think that we can turn that phone off or that bell off and kind of thing. And he said, well, it's just driving me crazy. I shut my door, but I could still hear it because it was closer to his mm-hmm. office mm-hmm. than it was down to my office. And he said, well, I'm going to take my work out to the front desk, and I'm going to answer the phone. I think that you won't get a lot done. And he said, well, it's better than just hearing the damn thing ring all the time. Okay. So now, most everybody who calls the governor's office wants to talk to the governor. Mm-hmm. And the front desk's job is to get them to the ombudsman or the affirmative mm-hmm. action or to transfer them over to an agency or something like that or to an assistant to the governor. You know, it's rare mm-hmm. that, you know, one in a 500 calls that comes in is going to go directly to the governor. And we didn't, you know. So he's picking up the phone, and I'm only hearing half the conversation. I'm hearing mm-hmm. his half, obviously. Mm-hmm. Governor Atiyah. He doesn't answer at governor's office. He goes, Governor Atiyah. No, this is Governor Atiyah. No, ma'am, this really is Governor Atiyah. I'm in the governor's office, and I'm talking to you now. And this would go on, call after call after call, and he would be sitting there taking notes about so-and-so, call back this person regarding whatever mm-hmm. and something like that. And then finally he came in and he said, I can't keep this up. This is ridiculous. I'm going to go in and close my door and if maybe put a blanket or something over that telephone. So, yeah, Governor Atiyah. Mr. Kim, somehow or other, when we went back to Washington, D.C. one time, this is early on because mm-hmm. this is when H.W. was vice president. Mm-hmm. And H.W. and the governor were compadres, not less so than Jerry Ford.
Right.
But still,
same,
kind of thing. And there's actually two stories that deals with Bush. But Mr. Kim was his driver nowadays, and he was just a chauffeur. He was not mm-hmm. a secret service. And I'm sure that has all changed, and I'm sure that you've got to be packing heat kind of whatever. But he was a wonderful, wonderful man. And basically the vice president said, well, why don't you take my car, since you're just here with taxis. You shouldn't be in a taxi. And Mr. Kim will drive you around. Well, they became great friends. We have pictures, I'm sure, over in the archives of the governor and Mr. Kim, and they corresponded back and forth, and mm-hmm. and he would always give him pins and things that were related to that. We went back there when H.W. was getting ready to run for president, mm-hmm. and the vice president has an office in the West Wing, and so mm-hmm. we were in the vice president. Normally, it would be over in the executive office building. So we're in there, and you know, these two mild-mannered, very similar personality people, but with great senses of humor. Now, I had told any politician, and I would continue to give this advice to anybody, if you're meeting with somebody important and you envision that picture will be on your wall someday, do not do a grip and grin. Mm-hmm. Because that screams this was a posed picture.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not say that, in fact, you had an important meeting with an important person. In 87, I gave that advice to Governor Kay Orr of Nebraska when she was meeting with Reagan. And she said, I've received lots of political advice. And she came back, she was just floating high. She just worshipped Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
And she's, that's the best political advice I've ever had. And because I said, you know, sit down. You're going to be in the Oval Office? Oh, yeah. I said, sit down and be talking to him. You know, I don't care what it is, but make it look like you're having this exchange of ideas on the Middle East or some darn mm-hmm. thing. And she got this wonderful picture, and it's still on her wall, I'm sure, on Brent Boulevard. So I'd given advice to the governor and to Jerry mm-hmm. on this subject many, many times.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came in with the photographer, and it's literally set up where there's a couch, and the vice president is here, and the governor is here, and Jerry is here, is there, and I am down here.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in, and the picture they take is like this. Okay, and you know, we're all just together, and there's not. So I went to Craig Fuller, and mm-hmm. he's getting, you know, he's asking for his endorsement so that mm-hmm. he can carry Oregon and all this kind of mm-hmm. stuff, which of course was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you're going through the motions,
mm-hmm.
and so I said to Craig afterwards, I said, when the meeting is breaking up, can we get individual pictures? And I could have said, can I have an office in the West Wing for the day?
Mm-hmm.
I could have got, we could have gotten anything, but I mm-hmm. said just individual pictures. Oh, sure. That official photographer comes in, governor gets up. Grip and grin.
Yeah.
Jerry gets up, grip and grin. I get up, and I go, and he starts, the vice president starts to do this, and I go, Mr. Vice President, that's going to look like every posed picture in the world. And he goes, okay, Denny, I'll look like I'm briefing you. He gets it. He knows exactly what I'm doing.
Yeah.
And Barbara and my late wife, Molly, and even Holly, my first wife, point out that I ruin this incredible picture by telling the story every time somebody looks at that picture, because it's clearly a posed picture that's not looking like a posed picture.
Right.
But it's worth it.
Right.
Anyway, the governor didn't get it. So, okay, Mr. Kim, I will talk to Tom, see if we can't. The joke file is just a joke file. I mean, it's
yeah, I know,
but it should be a part of the archives.
Yeah.
Okay, French restaurant. I kind of told you that one, but basically they delivered me a Big Mac instead.
Right, right.
And then I finally did get my dinner.
That's good.
Richmond. I think that may have covered our list of things I wanted to make sure you had. Okay.
Cool.
What?
Oh, good.
Oh, okay. Oh, leaks. I'm sorry. There are two other pages here. We had leakers in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And since there is no inconvertible, is that right?
Incontrovertible.
Incontrovertible.
Mm-hmm.
Without Barbara around, I'm dead. She's the former journalist and Fordham Phi Beta Kappa. And uh-huh. I'm the OSU C-minus student. Evidence of who those are. So I'm not going to tell you
mm-hmm.
who they are
doesn't really matter.
It really doesn't make a difference. But it just drove the boss crazy.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. And I said, well, there's an easy way to solve this problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the septic tank answer. What do you mean the septic tank answer? I said, well, when they're looking for a leak in the septic tank, they flush fluorescent dye down the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
And they go out, and wherever it shows up, sometimes they use a black light, wherever it shows up, you know where the leak is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, well, we're not going to be like flushing dye down somebody, are we? And I said, no, but what we're going to do is if we have a suspect, we're going to give them official, real information that's a little bit attractive, but that we really don't care whether it's released or not, and we're not going to give it to anybody else. Oh, and if it shows up in the press from a source in the governor's office mm-hmm. or a source of whatever, mm-hmm. we're going to know exactly. So we knew exactly who talked to who. Mm-hmm. We had it all mapped out.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't fire anybody over that. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't fire anybody anyway, but we would have the ability of identifying who we could trust in the mm-hmm. governor's office and who we couldn't trust. He said, look, I'm open to everything. I have never used my family in any campaign. Now, you may have found, and this may prove to not be the case, but he said, I don't do the standard family picture with my kids and all this kind of stuff. And as a result, my kids' life is their private life. And
right.
Suzanne has said when she gets married, and I forget who she was getting married to in that time, She wants it to be private and have no press there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that she was getting married was known by the press, and this is that post-Watergate era,
mm-hmm.
and they took it on as a challenge, and they, mm-hmm. in fact, busted it. They told everybody when it was going to be, where it was going to be. Suzanne was in tears, and the governor was just very upset about the whole thing. We did literally come in, like, heads down about, oh, we got another revenue crisis and so on, and we used to have, it's now out of the office, they moved it downstairs or something, but it was this nice piece and it had a whiteboard that was closed most of the time, and you'd open it up and that was where the tax plan and the revenue plan was written on and so on and so forth, and we just were saying, okay, here we go again, another verse, another chapter, governor goes over, opens it up, and it's the last one that we just had completed that with a little tweaks of, you know, this has got to be 0.5 instead of 0.6 and things like that. And we didn't know whether to laugh or cry, but it made an impact on us, literally. Bustamante. Bustamante was one of Suzanne's husbands, and he was an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Not a renowned artist, but an artist, and a nice guy, by the way. And so the governor, in a speech to, like, the art commission or some arts group, just decided to test everybody just a little bit, or maybe make some fun. But people, when you tell the story to, think he was making fun of them. That wasn't his intent, but it could have made fun of them. And in the speech, and David may be the one who helped him with this, I don't know, I can't remember, but I remember that he went through and he said, you know, we're all familiar with the great artists of the world. And then Cezanne, Renoir, Bustamante, and he just, you know, right in the middle put this in there, and they all were just going, But I'm sure afterwards, did you hear, Bustamante kind of thing. But they, you know, the emperor's no clothes kind of thing, new clothes.
Yeah.
They didn't want to bust and say, well, excuse me, governor, who's Bustamante? Well, he's my son-in-law. And, oh, okay, right, that's fine. when we had to get the pistol, which Jimmy has evidently was given to him by the governor, that he found in the governor of Holmes between the seats. We had to get it back from Syria. Well, you don't just take a pistol, because we were going to Israel and we were going to do all this other kind of stuff, and the governor said, handle it, you know, take care of it. Well, we put it in the pouch. That was the secret way to get stuff back in the State Department. Well, the State Department didn't like that at all, and Jerry tells the story of them calling up, and they said, why they did it this way, I don't know, but they were just raging mad. Misuse of the pouch, and we got to, you know, you can't stop this and all. And by the way, are you aware of the GUN that is in the pouch? And she said, you mean a gun? Yes, yes, they put a gun in the pouch. I mean, that's just outrageous. They said, well, did it cause any problems? No, it wasn't loaded or anything like that. But that's, you know, it was the example of the ultimate insult. Mm-hmm. But Lon thought it was a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
He would also, he bought a sword and he brought it in. It's just, and we had to figure out a way of packing it to, mm-hmm. to bring it home.
Mm-hmm.
We would, when Lon and I would get into a hotel, the first thing we did was ask people if they had many boxes. And I would bring along a roll of filament tape because we knew the boss was going to be collecting, buying, doing things like that. And so.
That's great.
Okay, I'm going to give you two documents.
Okay.
This is my take on the Columbia Gorge National Scenic Act. This is
fantastic.
This is my part of my little document that I told you about before.
So this is the same conditions? Or is this just straight to me?
Yeah, you can quote it. I'm quoting mostly other people in there.
Okay, okay.
I really wanted to know, personally, a long time ago, actually, and then some books came out recently, and I updated it. I just wanted to know what really happened, because we were reporting on it from the side of the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, everybody, this is one of those issues, it's like Rajneesh. The Rajneesh issue, had it gone sour, and it could have, as you know, gone sour big time. Had it gone sour, Dave Frohmeyer, Norma Paulus, you know, Turner was a straight-up guy. He'd have taken whatever heat was necessary. But all these people who now are out, who afterwards, Dave obviously is not doing anything right now, and Norma can't, but they all like to beat their chest about all they did for the Rajneesh problem. And, of course, the governor's policy was to
stay quiet and not even meet with them. And so he was as low profile as you possibly could be.
Yep.
But the same thing on the Columbia Scenic thing. There was a lot of local opposition, especially on the Washington side of the river.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor convincing John Spellman and the governor basically keeping the president from vetoing it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that, you know, again, we didn't make a big deal because the governor told me not to make a big deal of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to make sure that what I had. And now, of course, the environmentalists see it as one of the greatest thing since sliced bread,
mm-hmm.
and certainly Mark Hatfield and Bob Packwood had a lot to do with it. It was federal legislation,
yeah.
as did the delegation in the state of Washington, as did our congressional, the mm-hmm. members of Congress. But Bob Packwood wanted more control by the federal government,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't like to be told that now because he doesn't see himself as a big government kind of guy
right.
all the time,
right.
and yet that's exactly the position he was taking, and he and Hatfield were sparring back and forth on that whole issue.
Mm-hmm.
And Hatfield, to some degree, also was kind of much, they're oriented that way in Washington.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They think that they do a really good job back there and that mm-hmm. they should be the ones telling the states what to do. Well, that wasn't the governor's position at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so he doesn't get, in my opinion, as much credit for having it crafted in the right way. The people who wanted it not even to happen were mad at him. The people who wanted it to be a total federal government national monument
mm-hmm.
status were unhappy with him. And yet he figured out a way to make it happen and keep it from being vetoed. Would it have happened later with another president? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that it happened then, I think, is he gets the lion's share. Now, I'm certainly biased.
Yeah. Just that context, because I've been trying to figure out. I don't think this deserves a whole chapter.
No.
But it's
this is the last page of that.
It then puts it into a nice opposition to Opal Creek, where Opal Creek doesn't happen
right.
under him. Opal Creek happens later.
Right.
There's nice.
Well, what his
Opal Creek is just tied up in family too. So
right.
It's nice.
Right. Right. And you're aware of the story of Willamette Week. And Opal Creek, and Jawbone Flats, and all that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
They had a freelancer who, I can't think of his name, but he was a freelancer, not a regular reporter.
Mm-hmm.
And the only press the governor did not want to meet with, and this had to be an exception, was Willamette Week. He said, I don't care if I ever meet with those sons of bitches again.
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much told me that he was going to be busy anytime they wanted mm-hmm. to meet with him. I said, well, they can come to your media village. He says, that's fine. But in terms of a private sit-down meeting with them, all they're doing is getting information to screw me over, and I'm not about to put up with that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of true,
mm-hmm.
in most cases. So I forget who was publisher and who was editor at that point, but it was Meeker, or one of the
mm-hmm.
people that are still involved in it. So and he calls me up, and he says, we got a guy who says that the Hewitt connection with Jawbone Flats and basically Dolores's father and
mm-hmm.
on all of the various mining claims, that the governor benefited financially because he was the person who cleaned up the estate after he died.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a total blue sky, bootstrap, scammy kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept finding stock certificates and he's going through these papers and trying to get a hold of people. And he said, just a nightmare to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you know him well enough to know that he was doing it absolutely by the book and straight up
mm-hmm.
and all this kind of stuff. And so the thing from Willamette Week to me was, we need to meet with him. And I said, well, he's got a really tough schedule right now. Yeah, we knew. They knew we were
mm-hmm.
blocking them out. And he said, but here's the ultimate threat. We have to go with what we have if we don't have a chance.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, okay, here's what I will do. I will advocate for the meeting if you come with this contract reporter. Well, I don't normally do that. I said, I understand, but you're going to make the decision whether the story runs or not. And I can tell you there's nothing there. I know personally there is nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And if you tell me if there's nothing there, that you will not, just run a story because you've got something and you might as well throw the grenade in the room and watch the blood spatter against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. So I said, if you come and you listen to the questions and you don't like what the answers are or something like that, you obviously, First Amendment, all that kind of stuff, it's fine. So this contract reporter or freelancer brings in literally a box with hanging file folders in it.
Mm-hmm.
He's been working on this for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And every question he asks, the governor has an immediate and direct answer. No, that's not true. That actually was filed over here and done this way. And, you know, he had incredible knowledge of it and debunked every allegation of any kind of misdoing whatsoever. And so as we're walking out and the freelancer's walking out ahead of us, and I went over to whoever was publisher or editor, and I said, "What do you think?" And he said, "We're not running a story." Mm-hmm. And so that was the connection with Opal Creek. But there's the Lower Deschutes that the governor was involved in. With regard to wilderness, he said, it's not a question as to whether we have wilderness or not. It's a question about how much.
Yeah.
And the issue on wilderness was we had rare one, rare two, rare three. You know, the rares are still going on.
Yeah.
And now we've gotten to the point where we have an area that's got a bunch of roads on it, and it's been logged and everything else, but we're going to destroy the roads, and we're going to let the forest go back naturally, and we're going to make it into a wilderness area.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just... It's like, okay, wilderness is a really good thing, he would say, but it's just a matter of whether we turn the entire state or not into something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to make those good decisions. And then you know all the story about the forest plan and things like that.
Right.
I also looked at the judicial stuff. And so this again is just...
Oh, great.
It's more a matter of places that you could go find other information on his initial appointments to the court. And Gillette, now retired... I ran into him at one of the old fogies meeting out at Lake Oswego.
Yeah.
And he proceeds to tell me in chapter and verse about the great appointments that were made by the governor. You know, getting somebody from Eastern Oregon, getting someone who practiced law and wasn't just a jurist. You know, bringing in a real seasoning to the court with regard to that. And it's a part that is boring as hell.
Yeah.
But it's something that often isn't looked at that much.
And it's something that did not... primarily go through the appointments people.
Right.
It's partly, this is what he would call Jack Faust and other people. And
Wally Carson. Yeah. And
well, but after Wally got on the court,
he couldn't do it then.
He didn't do it.
So this was just more on openness, and again, you can quote whatever you want from that. I have no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this was, and you didn't get back to me, so I didn't know if you wanted to play that my game of you can take a look at this and ask me all the questions you want, but let me just use it as notes, and then these words do kind of follow under the rule that you and I had.
Okay.
I'll give it to you, but I want to talk through some of these things, and then we need to get to your questions.
Yeah, so whatever's on the table will be there, and yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's as far as I'm concerned. And some of these have to do with what I believe were mistakes, because I think that's something that the governor would want, and it's all my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
He may not have thought these were mistakes. He thinks it's a mistake that we didn't blow up the sign, for example, to his dying day, and probably now thinks that we should have blown up the sign.
Right.
Before
you get started, just one thing that I just discovered.
Okay.
Mistakes. So he, when he became governor, Atiyah Brothers, and you know he was Atiyah Brothers, they made it very clear they would have no state contracts.
Right.
And
he did,
so
it before that, when he was in the legislature, they won a contract for the ceremonial office.
Yeah,
in
1963.
And it got bad press, and he said, after that, we're not going to go for any state contracts.
Exactly. So I just discovered that.
Yeah.
And so I've got to go to the Tia Brothers and say, do you have contracts on this? And I want to go through the archives and find out, because they were the low bidder. So who were the other bidders? You know, that kind of thing.
Right. Good point.
But it's just...
No, he told that story regularly, that it was far better for them to simply not do business with the state while he was a state senator. And certainly when he became governor, was he still listed as president of Atiyah Brothers?
He was up till the end.
Okay.
It was weird because there's the president of Atiyah Brothers, but then the brothers held different positions on the board.
Right.
It would rotate around.
Right.
Who's the president of the board? Who's the secretary?
And it wasn't that long after he left office that they made the decision. And the way he would tell it to me was, you know, we didn't want to be in a situation like we were when Dad died.
Yeah.
They wanted to pass it on.
Yeah.
And that's when the whole business of him wanting his family involved and the others had more votes and.
Right,
you know.
The others were exactly right.
Of course.
And that's what the process that. They're going through now to pass it on to the next generation and managers.
Right.
But same thing. Did you know Ed sold his house?
No.
Because when Tom was shutting down the governor's house and all the stuff with that, Ed looked at that and said, I can't leave my kids to do that.
Interesting.
And so he sold the house and moved. He lives with, just across the highway. Donnie Campbell lives over there too.
Mm-hmm.
But he saw the experience and he said, I can't do that to my kids.
Yeah, what an amazing guy, Ed. I didn't get to know Richard that much, but Ed was, he's just such a wonderful human being.
Richard, pain in the ass.
Well, I honestly didn't know. I never got to really know Richard.
Yeah.
But, and primarily because Ed was always so incredibly supportive.
Yeah.
And Richard really was unhappy that there was a brother who was involved in helping the state and not helping the family business.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
and he also very cognizant of the fact that they gained a lot of business, but they also lost a lot of business.
Sure,
of that.
So, sure, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay, so some of these are mistakes, some of these are just kind of the milieu, and, mm-hmm. and I, both Jerry and I have expressed to each other the concern that people don't understand what was really happening technology-wise, size-wise, and everything else in terms of state government
mm-hmm.
in 1979 to 1987.
Mm-hmm.
And so a part of this is to get on the record, if you will, mm-hmm. some of those points.
Mm-hmm.
And it also goes into a little more detail about what I think are some mistakes that were made, starting off with Lee Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
So, and these are my notes, and again, you can have these afterwards if you don't mind mm-hmm. just using whatever I say here.
Yeah,
anything else.
No problem.
Okay, so initially, the Straub people came to us and said, you know, or Straub himself said in a note, you know, I recommend you appoint two transition people, one a general transition officer and one of the documents. The box that is not taped closed
mm-hmm.
that I just delivered to Ava,
mm-hmm.
you should probably get over there in the next week before she really puts it all away someplace because there's some really choice stuff in there. There's some Bardsley polling information. There's a note from the governor when Norma starts to run for governor and starts to trash the Atiyah administration in his handwriting that says, I am sick and tired of this shit. You get a hold of Norma and you tell, you know, it's written out in very direct language. There's some good stuff in there and some stuff that you may want to at least, I mean, I'm down to the point now where Barbara said, shouldn't this go in your own scrapbook? And I said, my scrapbook is now at Pacific University.
Mm-hmm.
And they have more stewardship over it than my great nephews are going to have or mm-hmm. anybody else in this world who's going to care. And she's personally going through all of her mother and her aunt's stuff right now, and she understands that.
Yeah.
But I've just gotten rid of it all. I figure if I want to see it, it'll be cataloged. Somebody will have it already.
Yeah.
Okay, so we appointed Travis and Travis Cross and Lynn Newbery. Both people the governor knew very well, Lynn more than Travis. And Lynn did all the budget stuff, and Travis did everything else, which was mostly personnel at that point. And the story that the governor tells that you probably already have, which is, you know, Lynn and Lee Johnson come in with the whole plan for tax and revenue, and he sat there and listened and nodded his head. And now, let me tell you what we're going to do, kind of thing.
Right.
The first time that Lee Johnson may have realized that the governor really meant it when he said, look, I'm going to be much more involved in the detail and things mm-hmm. like that. And so Travis, in some respects, was kind of a mentor to me, mm-hmm. although there was times when the word was that Travis was suggesting that maybe it was time for Denny to go. Now, there's a long list of people mm-hmm. who were out saying it's time for Denny to go.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them came around at the end of the whole thing saying that I was he said modestly, one of the best people around because I actually had credibility with the governor mm-hmm. and could talk to him and convince him of things, and, mm-hmm. and I knew what the hell I was doing, obviously. But having said that, Travis was still kind of a mentor, and there's a picture over there in the archives of a photographer wanted to have, during the transition, a picture of the governor with the state flag and the U.S. flag as a background to mm-hmm. it. And then he backed up and took a picture of Travis and me holding the two flags, which is a cherished picture.
Uh-huh.
We had lunch, and he said, Denny? He said, am I missing something here? The governor-elect just does not have a list of people that he has been thinking about for X number of years. He ran for governor in 74.
Mm-hmm.
He started running for this position multiple years ago, basically, mm-hmm. in his head, and yet he doesn't have a list of people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he knew who he was going to fire. He fired Dan Goldie the day after the election. You know, mm-hmm. he brought him in summarily and for his execution into the campaign office and said, you no longer have a job.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm sworn in, you're sworn out kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But he didn't know who to replace him with at that point. And I said, well, I said, I've known him just since 77. But and so he had, you know, according to my understanding from the boss, he kind of wanted Lynn Newbery to be the chief of staff or the executive assistant. But Lynn told him even before the election, don't ask me because I can't do it. And then he wanted Jerry Thompson. And you've heard her story about how Travis sat up and said you could have any building you want and all. But, you know, Travis was basically an old sexist coot from the old days and didn't think about appointing women chief of staff, and so that was kind of ridiculous. And I think it was what I call, through a lot of materials and discussions we've had, the influentials or the influencers or whatever you want, these behind the Jack Faust, Doug Hyders of the world that were trumpeters and were close to him. But by the way, you know the story that before the election, they all wrote down in the primary election, all the trumpeters wrote down who was going to win the primary, and they put their name on it and folded it all up, sealed it, put it in the thing, and then the idea was after the election, they were to open it up with the winner in the room, and none of them picked Nicotia to win. Yeah. None of them. Not the entire group of influentials picked him to win.
Yeah.
And so I don't know how or who, and you may know, but how Lee Johnson came to the top. Obviously, very, very bright guy, but not suitable to be executive assistant or chief of staff.
I've got, from Victor and some other things, I can do the top three, possibly four, but Lee Johnson doesn't pop up.
Right.
So I have no idea. I have no idea in the world.
Well, anyway, and as a result, he didn't really have, with the exception of me and Shirley, didn't have, and bringing over from the campaign, I mean, Paul Phillips was an assistant ombudsman or something like that. Carol Whitney was affirmative action director for 9 months or less or something like that. And so, and none of the other people in the campaign wanted jobs. You know, so there was no pressure from to somehow or other bring Carol Whitney in as executive assistant, although she might have thought so. And and I didn't know how the system worked or anything else. But then when Lee came in, Bob Oliver, who was, you know, the consummate professional, worked in multiple administrations, Jim Russell, and Pat Amadeo came in, I think, at the recommendation of Bob Duncan, who was, you know, very, very close to the governor, even though of a different political party, probably more aligned with him politically than a lot of Republicans were at that time. And so all these people came in that weren't necessarily personally loyal to him.
Right.
And they were in many ways loyal to Lee, but not him. Betty Modlin comes in, who'd been Lee's close assistant for years and years and years. And so we had an organization that was focused more on the executive assistant than on the governor. And that started going south in 30 days. I mean, it really, you could sense it. And I was not invited to meetings, and the only time I was invited was when I was told how I was to advocate, and I refused to do that. So
yeah, the outside evidence I have is the Kelly Wood nomination.
Yes.
You have Lee is threatening people in the Senate.
Right.
It's like, you're kidding me. But
yeah. Well, then there's a news article that talks about him as being the hatchet man, and he denies it. But anyway, having said that. Not involved with the search. Jack Faust, Roger Martin, probably more so than anybody else. In Lee's defense, obviously the smartest guy in most rooms, first of all. Secondly, he had come of age in bigger environments with Bob Davis and Ed Westerdahl as McCall's chiefs of staff and Keith Burns and Bud Kramer as Governor Straub's chiefs of staff, and they pretty much ran state government for their governors. They kept Bob Straub out of things. McCall just didn't want to be involved in things.
Right.
McCall was up here looking down at the world and thinking of big thoughts and so on and so forth, while Westerdahl and Davis ran things or tried to run things, and they pretty much ran state government. So that was the model that Lee brought in. So in his defense, the governor says he made it clear to him that was not going to be the case. More than once, I was in a meeting where Lee and the governor and I were there, maybe other people were there, and Lee would go, Governor, you got to back me on this, because I've already said it. And if you don't back me on this, my credibility is going to be shot with the Democratic leadership and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's like, you got to support me here because otherwise I'm going to be useless.
Right.
And maybe the governor should have, but I never saw him doing that. I said, Lee, I'm sorry. You just ran down a completely dead end that's not where I want to go, and so I can't. Now, if you like, I'll explain that we had some miscommunication or something like that, and you have my full faith and all. But, you know, more than once, he was begging to be backed up on some silly-ass thing that he had done on behalf of the governor.
Do you know if Jerry knows these stories?
She's
not there.
Yeah.
But when she was hired, do you know if there was a communication about that kind of stuff?
Well, you've seen the memo, the transition memo from Lee to her.
Yeah. The reason I ask is she is encountering similar issues. She does not do anything the governor doesn't want her to do, but the negotiations with the Rajneeshis are just intense.
Right.
And there's a lot of the Rajneeshis and John Mathis, the federal mediator, saying, well, this is what I've said. This is what is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And she's rock solid. No, the governor and I are exactly the same on this.
Right.
No, you can't do that. And it seems like a counter to that kind of relationship, that kind of understanding. So I'm just...
She was... aware that there had been problems, and she was aware of the fact that basically Lee had been fired. I mean, the governor calls Jack Faust and says, "Help me out of this."
Yeah, okay.
And Jack, being the trooper, takes care of it. Mm-hmm. Calls up Lee and says, "You're no longer going to be the executive assistant.
Right.
You're probably going to be able to be a judge someday again if you want to be, but you know that's it.
You're not going to run BPA."
Yeah, and a few other things. That would have been. So Jerry was aware of that because now the governor is more specific than ever when he hires her.
Yeah.
You know, I need to be kept in the loop. I need to not be surprised. I need, you know, this. He hated surprises.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get a binder that I called Jerry last night or yesterday afternoon. I said, the binder that you gave to me to look over, do you want me to give that to Jim now? And she said, I've got to look at it. I can't just, and it is, but I can tell you what's in it. And she said, tell Jim he's going to get it, or tell the archive that they're going to get it. And it's from the day one, she is writing him daily memos with things like, they swept the floor in your office that day. Not exactly that, but things like, I mean, it's so into minutia that it's an insight into any time the governor was not in a cabinet meeting, which by then, because we're talking... Jerry 921 of 81.
Yeah.
So he's doing a lot more traveling at that point.
Yeah.
And so anytime there was a cabinet meeting, either Bob Oliver or Jerry would write a summary. And if Jerry talked to somebody, Stubbs Stewart called and said this, and so and so wonders if you're going to take care of this person, and the strong recommendation for so and so to be appointed to whatever, and all this kind of stuff. And she had a typewriter hidden aside her desk, because being a big-time executive in those days, if you had a typewriter and you were a woman, you were a secretary.
Right.
So she had it hidden down where people couldn't see it when they came in for meetings. She'd pull it up, and she was an expert typist and was able to type out these memos. So it's just full of those kind of memos keeping him informed, more so than I think was even necessary. And then during the campaign, he would return them to her with notes on it, like, yes, or I need to talk to you about this, or... And what it shows more than anything else, again, is his incredible involvement in details.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess that I would even personally say more so than he should have been. Because it burdened things down. It slowed things down. Yeah. And agency heads, you know, the often quoted thing of you hire good people and you let them go and you stay out of their way kind of thing, didn't seem to apply to the CEO, COO, chief of staff kind of position that he wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And he was involved in that, and that's what he wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it worked out. I mean, things worked out, but it probably slowed the process down in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that Lee says in the memo, in the transition memo of, you know, Daryl Rawls getting in to see you, and, you know, that just undercuts, number one, your chief of staff, and number two, they can make the case directly to you on an argument that maybe you shouldn't even be involved in.
Yeah.
And then they get your support and they run off. And that's true. I mean, the people in any kind of an intergovernmental kind of education at the Harvard Business School or the Kennedy School or something like that would say, don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it turned out, mm-hmm. you know, and because he did know everything and he was able to stand up in front of the media on a weekly basis and pretty much respond to everything.
Mm-hmm.
Very few things did we have to, quote, get back to them on, something
right.
like that.
Right.
Very few things.
Right.
Okay, so it was, in my mistake, it was, and you've heard the story about Nendell's.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There were just the influentials again. They just thought they misjudged him, and they thought he was going to be easy to control, and
mm-hmm.
they didn't know the stubbornness factor.
Just so
at
you
all.
Know, the very first time I talked to him on tape, after he talked about the ground rules. Which were none.
Yeah.
And the assumptions, which were exactly my assumptions, this isn't about Vicatea, it's about the Times with a guy named Vicatea in it.
That's right.
That kind of stuff.
Right.
But the very first story you told was the business community and how they wanted him. And he listened and said, well, but A, you've always been weird. And B, no, we have to go do this. And standing up to him and how they were just flustered.
They all thought, and many of them then proceeded to go out of business.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
many of them got over their heads and their companies are no longer around,
mm-hmm.
and they were the most bombastic and the loudest and so on, and they'd sit and they would just berate him. I mean, we're talking
mm-hmm.
about lack of personal respect for the office,
yeah.
let alone the individual.
Yeah.
And so, you know, labor loved him but never endorsed him and would never even come close to him. Right.
Yes.
And he would demand that we would list all these things he had done.
Yeah.
And for the state employees, he was probably one of the nicest governors ever for state
yeah.
employees. And yet they just treated him like dirt. And the business community was looking for all of this control. They thought they were going to be able, they now were in office, you know, and it was
yeah.
a quid pro quo kind of thing. Although many of them, the ones who were the most helpful in campaigns were the least demanding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mm-hmm. Clarus Popperts of the world and Roy Livermores of the world were, you know, they were the ones who had the great respect. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, Roy Livermore was on the SAFE board and treasurer of the campaign when we stole $81 million
yes.
from SAFE.
Yes.
I mean, talk about, and we just never talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, Roy.
You told me a story that it was like an issue for a day or an afternoon or something.
Well.
And then Roy came in the next day and we just kept going.
He just gritted his teeth.
Yeah,
and I knew where he and was, but basically I said, I know where you are on this, and,
mm-hmm.
and I know that's a problem for you, but it has nothing to do with what we're doing here.
Yeah.
And he said, you're right, and then was gone.
Yeah,
right. And then he was the absolute loyal soldier, and you know, I looked at budgets for the campaign as you know big chunks going here and going here,
right.
and keeping it so that we didn't go into debt because
yeah.
that was one of the rules, and there
yeah.
was only two rules basically: win and don't leave me in debt.
Yes,
and
I
and
got great articles from '74 about every candidate being in debt.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. He said, "Do not leave me in debt.
Yeah.
If you leave me in debt, I'll haunt you for the rest of your life," kind of
yeah.
thing. And that was, as you know, part of the reason for the radio window mistake was
yeah.
that we were holding
yeah.
back. And Roy was the one at the end was saying, you know, we can raise more money. We need to spend more money, you know,
exactly.
kind of thing. Mr.
Exactly.
Conservative.
One more question before we go on.
Yeah.
Would Monty Montgomery be part of this business group? Or is he his own special case?
He is his own special case.
Okay. Because I've got great stories about him, and I've got notes that the governor kept all the legislative notes from his first two legislative sessions.
Really?
Every one.
Mm.
So it was a great one from Ed Fadeley. Don't you ever presume to think you know what I mean. It's like prickly from day one. But it's
well,
clear
Ed Fadeley
that
and Gretchen Cairns were the, you know, every other, I would say, and I wasn't in those leadership meetings.
Yeah.
But just from dealing with them in a public basis, with the exception of Gretchen Cairns and Ed Fadeley, we were very fortunate in the
mm-hmm.
Democratic leadership, given the fact that it was Democratic leadership the whole 8 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Vera Katz and
Katz and Kitz.
Yes,
yeah.
yes, yes.
Yeah.
And they were at least responsible, and they realized that the state was in trouble, and they were working for
mm-hmm.
it. Cairns and Fadeley were looking to screw the governor every time they could. I mean,
yeah.
they were just
yeah.
absolute hard-ass partisans about the whole thing, and probably still are. I don't. Ed Fadeley's got to be dead by
oh,
now. Oh,
he died last year.
Yeah, yeah.
yeah. And what did
but
he
But Grattan's still around.
Yeah, Grattan's still around. Ed Fadeley, in his will, left money to the city of Eugene for outdoor concerts in the summer.
Yeah.
It's like, all oh, that. Huh. No, the reason I asked about Monty Montgomery is just because he, as it's late, Kitzhaber is the president of the Senate by this point.
Right.
But there's a couple of cases where he is just a mean person in terms of telling people how he lords it over the governor and that kind of stuff. Oh. And so is he his own special case, or is he part of this business coterie at this point?
We've talked before, and I've pointed out my role as his quote resident cynic,
mm-hmm.
And because he had a personal blind spot for loyalty to friends that was not returned,
mm-hmm.
and loyalty that hung on too long,
mm-hmm.
and when Monty started getting into legal troubles and they were doing depositions, mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff and so on, he said, it can't be. It's not the Monty Montgomery I know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Monty was a manipulator. Is a manipulator.
Yeah.
And I don't know. Did you find out? Did he ever serve one night in jail, or did he simply?
I haven't pursued that part of it.
Okay,
yeah,
but the fact is that what Monty would do with everybody was basically try to schmooze them over and manipulate them, and mm-hmm. that was his style. That was mm-hmm. his style when he was a politician.
Yeah.
And so he, you'd call his office at was it AOL or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and he'd be at home, and the secretary would pull this ruse of, well, just a minute, let me get your call into the office, kind of thing. And then you could tell, if you were at all savvy about how telephone systems work, that you were being transferred to his home phone.
Yeah.
And when he was in the office, the story is that his secretary said, maybe even in court records someplace, that he would joke about how he could manipulate the governor and how he could get anything he wanted from the governor.
Yeah.
And that just is, for us, who were personally loyal to him, maybe to a fault, but it's just unbelievable that someone would do that.
Yeah.
But that was his history as Speaker of the House and everything else.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Yes, yes. Okay, so Glanna was never got on the campaign, but was brought in and then kept on way too long.
She leave of her own accord?
No.
Okay.
No. She went through a process of, well, there's a campaign story when we sent the governor to Sweet Home and then back to Lebanon and then back to Sweet Home and back to Lebanon.
Yeah.
And then I found out it was Glenna, and I just didn't tell the governor who it was. I just just took the arrow or the sword and fell on it.
Yeah.
But Glenna started doing things that were basically for Glenna and not for the governor, and,
uh-huh.
and it got worse and worse and worse. And she wasn't doing a very good job. And so all of a sudden he got, a really good secretary, and he found out what life could really be like on that. No, she didn't.
These are floor notes from his first 2 years.
Wow.
So you can just scope up and they move, but it's just a gold mine.
Yeah, no kidding.
Later on, he would only keep the ones that were actually pasted into the scrapbooks, so he was editing them. Here he just kept everything.
George Janela. Wow. That is cool stuff. He had a mistaken belief that you could hire really good business people in state mm-hmm. government and that they could run government like a business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I personally believe you cannot run government like a business,
right.
and that one of his mistakes was hiring really good business people. So he hired Tom Matarossi
mm-hmm.
to, I think, be the head of the executive department initially, or it mm-hmm. might have been Jim Bedingfield. But anyway, Matarossi is what the story is about. And he came in one day, and he was a classic, stereotypical, fiery Italian guy
mm-hmm.
who ran a forest products company down in Klamath Falls or someplace
mm-hmm.
down there in Southern Oregon. And he was just mad as hell. And he said, damn it, Governor. He says, in my business, when I tell somebody to do something, if they don't do something, I fire their ass.
Right.
Here, they look at me and basically tell me, I'm going to be here after you're gone, and I'm going to do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't do anything about it. What's the stupid part? And he just was ranting and raving. And it's true.
Oh, yeah.
It's absolutely true. And so it just almost never worked out when we brought somebody straight from the private mm-hmm. sector
in. And it gets back to that business of the business community sitting around that border control table, thinking that the governor should be able to do this and be able to do that and so on, and him explaining to them that, no, you understand that the Constitution says, you know, and I can't just do that. And, well, I don't know why you can't. You know, you're the CEO and that kind of stuff. And they're, quote, not getting their way, and as a result being very petulant about the whole thing. But yeah, a mistake of bringing in and bringing in really good people, Bedingfield and Matarossi and others out of the private sector, but setting them up for a situation that was not going to work out. Yeah. Now, are there examples where people have come out of the private sector? Yeah, but most of the time they were serving as legislators or whatever.
They
you know, Stafford Hansel, Bob Straub. I mean, you can go through people who have done that. And then on the other side of that, he pulls the exact opposite and makes a brilliant appointment in Leo Hagstrom, who's a lifer, and who knew everybody else who'd been brought in by previous governors to run the Department of Human Resources had been these outside, big-time people from out of state, and they were going to come in and, you know, quote, reorganize. How many times has that department been reorganized? And Leo just knew how to run the department, and he also understood the governor. And speaking of anecdotes, you've heard the anecdote about the hiring of Dave Fiskum when he came into my office, when Leo came into my office early on.
I don't know. No.
Okay, very quickly, Leo comes in, sits down, and this is just every meeting was like this. Came in, sat down, lit a cigarette. The governor comes in, sit down, light a cigarette. You know, that's just, that was, and I've never been a smoker, not even once. And he was very nervous, and he said, so Denny, I've got this position, head of public relations for DHR. I've told you.
You have told me.
Okay.
Yeah, you get into this. Yeah, absolutely. Got it.
And we were the ones who took, the governor took the party designation off of all of the appointments.
Yeah.
You know, there was what, two boards or commissions that required a partisan balance, like the Ethics Commission or something else. And that was the excuse for, and it's back on there, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's back on
there. It was on there the day you guys left. Well, not quite. Turns out, talking to Jill Thorne, no one had gotten a key to the office, and nobody knew how to turn on the lights. She had been around, so she knew where to find the state police, you know, and say, hi, can we get the key?
I thought the governor said that he handed Neil Goldschmidt a key.
May have been, but they showed up for work the next morning, and no one could get in, and no one knew where the lights
were. They probably changed the locks. I mean, that would have been good standard operating procedures. Okay, so I lost my train of thought.
Leo Hagstrom.
Okay, finished that. Anyway, he was, in fact, vulnerable to being misled by people.
Right.
And with the best of intentions, he just didn't seem to have the instinct that there were bad people out there who were willing to take advantage of the governor, because that concept was totally foreign to him.
Right.
Totally
foreign. So Glenna, does Glenna just kind of drift into not being effective? Or,
well, let me.
Or does she get, I'm the assistant to this guy and I'm, you know, bigger than this? I mean, what happened?
First of all, let me tell you that I wouldn't have ever been able to have worked for the governor as governor had it not been for Glenna. Glenna, I mean, the governor kept thinking, why in the world would he leave his position at Oregon State to go to work on my campaign? He didn't know that I had 1 year notice and that I was going to be out of a job. And I didn't tell him. I didn't tell my dad. I told my wife. I was the only person that really knew it. I can tell anybody now. I don't care, because it was really a good thing. She and I were close in the sense of she never did anything mean and nasty to me in any way, shape, or form. But she did have, in many ways, some tacit control over his schedule, although Jerry would point out that, no, the schedule was put together by the governor and the chief of staff and assistants to the governor. Somebody could get in through her, and she started actually controlling phone calls more than she should, and, you know,
this is all his committee assignments. 1971.
Wow.
Glenna Hayden, committee clerk.
Right.
So that's probably it.
Well, and she was the caucus administrator.
Yeah.
In '77.
Yeah.
And all she really did was sit in there and write quotes down from floor speeches given by Democratic senators.
One of these six.
Yeah, exactly. And, well, she would write down what the potential target seats were, where we at least had a chance of winning.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, this must be how it's done, but I couldn't figure that out. I was busy working the milk bottle bill and other things. So as part of this resident cynic role, and I'm randomly going around doing different things, I've told you about the red phone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 378-3333. And we knew it was him. Period. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Who else had the red phone?
Nobody.
Okay.
That was the whole point. The governor didn't even know what the number was.
Okay.
He had a button that said Denny.
Okay.
And it was, and he had two buttons on his Winter Street phone. One said Denny office, the other said Denny home.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't know what those numbers were, and he just pushed the button, and I said, yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And after three rings, Tim Marsh or whatever was my assistant at the time said, you know, Denny's not here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I thought it was one of the coolest things I did. It turned out to be a very, very good thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that, you talk about communication and
yeah.
not allowing some intern to answer the phone and not realize that it was the chief executive of the state of Oregon, you know, not going to happen. Another mistake. The infamous 1978 Woodburn meeting. And you've heard that story from Roger. You've heard it from the governor. Roger continues to say that it was just an honest effort to try and keep Tom McCall from winning. Mm-hmm. And when you tell him that the governor thought it was a total setup and that he was betrayed by his good friends. And again, those were the, quote, influentials or the influencers and that kind of thing. Oral history errors, okay? One of the things I've done is give you my printed copies of the oral history because they're online now.
I don't need anymore.
So they're all spiral bound and you can have them and do what you want with them. The boss tells the story of the man who died on the cross 2,000 years ago. You've heard that story.
Mm-hmm.
That guy died. Didn't that guy die on the cross? That was not in the Oregonian editorial board. That was in a media availability. He was talking about the Energy Facility Siting Council and... They asked, some reporter asked him, you know, what attributes are you looking? And he went on for like 4 minutes describing, you know, absolute integrity, you know, intelligence, on just this incredible description of this. And there was this 10-second pause. And then Henny Willis, who has incredible sense of humor, was the one who said, Governor, didn't that man die on the cross 2,000 years ago? And it was the end of the media availability. I mean, people... It was just so perfect. And it didn't happen in an Oregonian board editorial board meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The same section talks about Bob Smith being appointed the head of the executive department. He was the budget and manager of the budget division initially, not the head of... He became the head of the executive department, but he's talking about it initially.
Mm-hmm.
The governor says we referred to Ted Kulongoski as a labor lawyer. No, we referred to him as a union lawyer, because union lawyer just sounded much more sinister than labor lawyer or union attorney or any of the other possible connections. So he was always a union lawyer.
Right.
Yeah. If that's negative campaigning, Ted, that's what it is. Please, you know this, but Jim, please, double, triple check. Editors have a way of changing things, and they do it at the Statesman Journal when Barbara worked there and so on and so forth. You know, it is D-O-L-O-R-E-S.
Oh, yeah.
And make up a big sign for whoever is going through your various galleys and drafts and stuff. You know, do not change it. This is the proper spelling. And you might even go into, you know, this is the Spanish spelling of this word and whatever. And it would be the ultimate classic mistake. And so I bring it up here to cover my butt with history.
Along those lines.
Yes.
Had a really good time with Roy Hemingway, whose name is misspelled through the entirety of the Bob Straub book. And he has not read the Bob Straub book. I said, well, when you do, your name's misspelled every single time.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. Bob Straub simply was a better governor than that book.
Yeah, the book points out, the book leaves you with a governor who was diffuse, not served that well, except by this guy's dad.
Yeah, exactly.
And but a great treasurer.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, there's a lot more. And I'm kicking this up just with what I'm doing. It's like, you know, the Bob Straub, there was a lot going on here. And when I talk to people, there's just universal respect for Bob Straub and his elect.
Yes.
Absolutely. So it's just fascinating. It's just fascinating.
He and I would run into each other at the West Salem Roths, and this was when he was just starting to go downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And I would come up and I would say, Governor Straub, Denny Miles, Governor Atiyah's staff. Oh, yes, Denny, and so on and so forth. And about the third time that I did that. And
one of the few people you had to look up to when you.
Well, yeah, he was a formidable.
Yeah.
but about the third time he said, you know, a lot of people just call me Bob, but you always refer to me as governor, and you don't even necessarily say Governor Straub. I'm governor, you know, and I'm no longer governor. And I said, well, you know, that's a title you keep for life. And he says, yes, and it shows great respect for the office. And I said, well, obviously I have great respect for the office, and I certainly have respect for you, and yet I was on a campaign staff that defeated you. And I have referred to it, and I don't know if anybody else does or not, I've referred to it as kind of the Red Baron syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if somebody has a total disagreement with me or if I have any respect at all for their ethics or whatever. If they have run for office and or most important, if they have actually served in elected official office, I respect that office. And I may pull my punches with them personally and everything else, but damn it, if you've been governor of the state of Oregon, you know, it's probably only one exception to that, and we know who that is. And he basically smeared the office, in my opinion, so and the governor's as well. So yeah, he was a wonderful guy.
Did you read the New York Times?
You know, I have a friend who gets the New York Times, and I get the Wall Street Journal, and we trade clippings back and forth.
There was an amazing piece by John McCain along exactly these lines, an opinion piece. The last U.S. Lincoln Brigade person just died. Like age 102 or something. And John McCain wrote this really amazing piece about respecting the integrity of this guy.
He said,
politically, we would disagree on probably everything.
Lincoln Brigade.
This is the people who went to fight the fascists in Spain.
Oh.
And so he wrote this piece saying, you know, this is someone who went to fight and die for his ideals for strangers. You know, this is an amazing person. But he said, that respect for, you know, what you have done and who you are is just amazing.
Right. The review in the Wall Street Journal on the latest book on John Quincy Adams points out his, you know, joy and happiness of the years that he spent after president in the House of Representatives and how much more he enjoyed that elected office than anything else. And the review ends with what Barbara calls a gold coin, meaning you save a really cool little tidbit for the end of the story. And it points out that when he died, that one of the members of the committee that planned his memorial service was a young House member and from Illinois, Abraham Lincoln. And so, I want to go take a really good class in American history. Okay, you know about the danger thing, and you know that it says, this is from the oral history problems again. The ad that Ted complained about, the so-called dangerous ad, was not pulled after a week, as the governor said. It was only a week. And you know the story is that it wasn't only a week because I didn't want Ted to think that we pulled it because he told us to. Okay, not a correction, but an amplification of Dolores's role in the campaign. The governor talks about that, but one of the things he didn't talk about was her system of working a room. She would get a roll of stickers, and everybody she talked to got a sticker, and so she could look around and see who she hadn't talked to and get over and talk to them. Page 314, the engineering firm was CH2M Hill, and later he writes in another reference to CH2M Hill, who was on the Arab trade mission. It's Nofal Keshwai, and I don't know how to say or spell his actual name or whether he's even around, but he spoke Arabic and he was of Arabic descent from an Arabic country, and was representing CH2M Hill, which did have business in Saudi Arabia and in Egypt. The governor hand corrects where he talks about flights on page 318 between countries, and he hand corrects it as an error. He says Damascus, that we could not, in fact, fly from Damascus to Tel Aviv.
Right.
We had to go to Cyprus.
Right.
Okay. The whole business about the Tom McCall thing
and the Benson Hotel on 78.
Mm-hmm.
Brent Walt has it wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've told you that before.
Mm-hmm.
Has the governor told you that story, or have I told you that story?
I've got this from about four different angles, so tell me your
okay.
the story.
Okay. Well, he went down there, and he says, you know, I went down there because I thought, well, you know, his ego will be really crushed, and Tom mm-hmm. will not handle this well, and he was doing it out of respect, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion is that Steve Young talked him into it because Steve was trying to win a Republican general election and was hopeful that Tom McCall would at least back off and not, you know, do something really stupid or whatever. And because it was Steve and the governor who went down there.
Mm-hmm.
It was not anybody else. And he didn't tell me he was going, or I would have thrown my body in front of the truck
mm-hmm.
to keep him from going.
Mm-hmm.
And then, again, Walt tells a completely different story, but basically what was seen on television was only a tiny, tiny part of it.
Right.
They then go upstairs, and McCall just unloads on Kim Scarrett, and she's still around. I mean, she married Agnes Duncan, and,
mm-hmm.
and she could tell the story herself on something like that. And one of the most really difficult, and he probably was well stoked with bourbon or whatever,
mm-hmm.
if Tom was Tom, but, you know, a disaster, a mistake, if
mm-hmm.
you will. From all sides, but Brent has it wrong.
Okay.
Let me just quickly look. Sheila called to wish you well. Okay. I'm sorry. I have to look at this, and it's only my bride. Are we okay on
your? Yeah, we're doing great.
Okay. Okay. And of course, McCall immediately announces that he's not going to support either, no matter who would win, because he's going to go back to K2, and
mm-hmm.
Tom Dargan was always his backup on something like that. And he and I then had a really good relationship. He called me Din. And only two people in my entire life called me Din. Tom McCall and the campaign manager for KOR in Nebraska, who
mm-hmm.
I fell madly in love with, but I was married, she was married, and so we decided not to do anything about
mm-hmm.
it. And who's now gone, unfortunately, from breast cancer. But yeah, she called me Den as well. Okay, Duane Samples, and I believe it's Duane, although it's occasionally shows up elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you've delved into this yet or not. Okay, then I'll just give you my side, and you can use that for whatever it was. Starts off with the fact that Duane Samples is, I think he's down in California, he's out
mm-hmm.
now. This incredibly bright, incredibly smooth, articulate president of his fraternity, Stanford grad, you know, who went to Vietnam and came back screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's delayed stress syndrome or any other kind of thing is open for debate.
Mm-hmm.
But we did familiarization tours out there, and I had done one out at OSP, and I met him, but I knew the story.
Mm-hmm.
Shirley Woodrow went out and did a familiarization and came back and said to Bob Oliver in a personal staff meeting,
mm-hmm.
You know, Monday meeting, I think they were, you know, who is this Duane Samples and why is he in prison? I mean, this guy is bright and he's articulate and, you know, I just don't understand this. And Bob just quietly went to his office and pulled out because he'd been asking
mm-hmm.
for commutations. He'd been turned down in 79 and came back and gave him the file. And, of course, the murder and the wounding was just heinous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, entrails being spread out around the floor and all this kind of stuff. And Shirley just,
yeah,
you know, gave him back the file and said, I'm never going to say hello to this guy ever again kind of thing. But my bottom line take on it, because I was, you know, I was just simply doing it from the press side, is that he was ill-advised by some state psychiatrists, and he was ill-advised by people that did not provide him, including, Marion County District Attorney, nephew of Van Dyke, Dick Van Dyke, Van Dyke, anyway,
okay.
who was very ambitious and wanted to do things, who did not provide him with the counter advice. And so all he heard were the people who said, this guy had delayed stress syndrome, he's not a threat, it shouldn't be a problem. And the governor never, quote, pardoned him. He says that in his oral history, that it was the pardon. He commuted the sentence to 20 years. He never got out of prison at that stage because he still had several more years to
mm-hmm.
serve.
But it wasn't a pardon, it was a commutation, and then, of course, the commutation was reversed, mm-hmm. and all of that made even bigger news, and that led to the 60 Minutes interview with Mike Wallace, mm-hmm. which led to me commandeering the schedule for a week and getting him onto the cutting room floor, which right. he never appeared in.
You
so
be bland, yes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah, and I, of course, make jokes about that, about all he needed to do was be boring, and that came naturally to him. That's a joke. Again, the mistake was not commuting the sentence. The mistake, in my mind, was made by getting poor advice from others and not getting the right people. You were talking about how the governor makes decisions. Well, the basic approach with any governor, but especially this governor, was to provide him with the right people and the right information on all sides of the issue so that he could make a really good decision based upon what he wanted to do as governor. We talked a little bit about labor union relations. Early on, I grew up in a trucking company. Small, very mm-hmm. small. One, two people, two or three trucks, mm-hmm. specialized in heavy hauling, blue-white transfer. My dad worked for System and West Coast and ran truck line and, you know, all these other places. My grandfather was the oldest living employee of Consolidated Freightways. When he died on the job, basically on sick leave at 82 years old, he was like the first real employee that the partners of Consolidated Freightways hired. And so trucking has been, I mean, he ran wagon drayage for Buffalo Bill Cody wow. in Wyoming and was a cowboy in Montana. And, mm-hmm. you know, that's my grandfather. So it's in my blood. And when my dad started his own business, I was about 5 or 6 years old. And he went down, and all the guys in the union hall congratulated him and said he had to hire them now. And he said, well, if I need somebody, I'll be glad to hire a union guy. No, 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 you're a boss now. You can't haul freight. Bosses don't haul freight. And he said, quote, if I have to put a turret with a 20-millimeter machine gun on the top of my truck, I'm going to haul freight. Well, stupid thing to say to unions in mm-hmm. 1950, you know, just mm-hmm. really stupid. But he was too small and too likable for them to do anything about. So I come with a bias here, right. okay? But I said, why aren't we doing a right to work thing? Mm-hmm. I mean, aren't we just ripe for that right now with the economy the way it is and everything else? I mean, well, number one, he didn't want to really piss off his, quote, union friends, which he didn't have any mm-hmm. organized labor friends. He had Bill Fast and he had, you know, a couple of other very tiny little locals here and there and so on and so forth that we, you know, put in every ad of endorsements so that it would look like we had support from organized labor, but we didn't have support. And he said, I've got too many, this is long before the economy went to hell, I've got too many things to do, too much importance, and this would be, in fact, blood on the floor, kind of war, mm-hmm. because that's the way it is. Well, I am curious as hell as to what's going to happen now, because now what, the entire North Midwest is right to work, and all of the South has been right to work for a long time. And so I guess Oregon's political leadership's not going to allow it to happen, and there's too much money in unions, but he was dead set and always dead set against doing anything with regard to right to work. Mm-hmm. Not that he didn't believe that that was a good idea, mm-hmm. but he said, just, you know, we have too many things to do to fight that mm-hmm. battle, fight that war. PERS. I think you will find if I don't know whether that was a mistake or not. I would say it's a mistake, but that's my personal bias. Mm-hmm. So he probably made an incredibly wise decision mm-hmm. in terms of getting all the things done that he had to get done. Because he would have spent all his time and all his political capital on that kind of thing, probably lost, and mm-hmm. you know, then that's what he would be known for. PERS was really healthy when he left office. Mm-hmm. PERS had 5 board members. They then went to 9 or whatever it was mm-hmm. and pretty much packed it with union members. And they kept coming to us during these times saying, look at how healthy PERS is. We need to be, that's our money, and we need to be giving it to state employees. Now, you know, full disclosure, I get a nice PERS check every mm-hmm. month, and I work really, really hard mm-hmm. for that PERS check. So I'm certainly biased in terms of that. But the trouble that PERS is in now is not only because of, you know, investments not really paying off, but it's, in my opinion, and this is where actuaries and experts on this need to step up, but that the board later in the Goldschmidt administration started giving things away, and that's when the rules got loosened, and that's when the guarantees started happening, and
So, you know,
timing-wise and everything else, I think that's worth
understanding. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. On the milieu that's out there. 1979, the reporters, first of all, there was pounds of reporters down in the press room.
Mm-hmm.
The Oregonian had three people. The Journal had three people. The Statesman, the Capital Journal had their people. There were two wire services. There were two people that did nothing but provide radio clips to radio stations all over the state. Every television station had their own private office in what was the press room at that time and is now a lobby center. And they were all going to be Bob Woodward's.
Mm-hmm.
They were all looking for some huge scandal someplace along the line. Les Seitz, who's a good friend now, he didn't talk to me at all. He always talked to Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Lynn, well, fine, we don't have any problem with that, you know. But he thought that was a big deal that he could talk to Jerry. And I said, you know, okay, well, Jerry may not know some things that I know. So, you know, you do it. He said, well, I'll talk to both then or something like that. But that doesn't exist any longer. Mm. And so if people think that what we were operating on is anything at all like what's happening now or what was even happening 10 and 15 years ago before newspapers started going in the toilet, it was a whole different environment.
Mm-hmm.
And this business of doing weekly media availabilities is something that just would be unheard of today. No governor since Governor Attia could possibly make that happen.
Yeah.
Now they have dueling statements issued by emails back and forth, and the press lets them get away with it.
Yeah.
So that milieu is completely different now than it was back then. I came back from Nebraska in late 87. I went to Nebraska to help KOR set up her new office,
mm-hmm.
and then went to Washington, D.C. when she appointed David Carnes to the United States Senate when Senator Zirinsky died in office, and decided I didn't, with all due respect to my friends in Nebraska, did not want to live in Lincoln, Nebraska, and certainly did not want to live in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came home. And I came back, and I went down to the press room, and I don't know whether it was AP or who it was. I think it was AP. And I said, what in the heck is going on around here? I said, you know, the governor's wife is sleeping with the security guy, and the governor is having sex with all these different people, including state agencies, including oral sex and the Economic Development Department. And,
mm-hmm.
and I said, and I'm not seeing anything coming out of the news media.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going from, you know, everybody wants to be a Bob Woodward,
mm-hmm.
to, and here was their answer. Oh, Denny, that's a personal matter. That has nothing to do with state government.
Mm-hmm.
Well, baloney, it has a lot to do with state government. And turns out it did have a lot to do with state government. And you know, they just completely... And now maybe it was because he was a Democrat and he was a god and all this kind of stuff, but even since then with Kitzhaber... Kitzhaber, as you may know, keeps little bound black book diaries, and was every time you had a meeting with him, he was writing in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, that's an open record. Mm-hmm. And it's got all sorts of stuff in it, I'm sure. Oh, it's his personal diary. I said, he is creating it in public meetings in his own hand.
Mm-hmm.
It is an open record.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no, we're not going to go for that. I mean, what happened?
Yeah.
They've become lapdogs.
Yeah.
And I don't know when it happened or how it happened, but it happened. He wouldn't talk to Willamette Week. We've already talked about that. You've heard...
Bill Kiesling is apologetic about that at this point.
Apologetic about what?
About the way Willamette Week was with the governor.
Well, they're still the same way with any Republican. I mean,
they don't have to be a Republican. They're that way with any government.
Well, that could be. They're just anti-establishment.
I mean, at this point, Republicans in the state are goldfish in a bowl.
Yeah.
They're just too easy. Yeah, they do it with anybody.
Well, and Republicans are, I mean, with...
They're rare.
Well, A, they're rare, and B, the kind of Republicans, whether you agree with them or not, I mean, the Tony Meekers and the Bob Smiths and the Wally Carsons,
yeah,
and
they're gone.
They're not around. They just don't. They fail at recruiting good people. In other words, we don't have a bench, as they say, and they don't worry about it. And Democrats have such a registration edge now that it's. I mean, my lifetime is pretty well doomed.
Yeah.
At this
point.
I did
a post legislative session thing with legislative leadership, and Mike McLean was there, and I have no respect for Mike McLean.
Well, I'm surprised. Nobody does.
No.
I'm surprised. Why is he still there?
I have no idea.
Position?
But it was, you know, I was in and out, and you know they were gabbing, but I had to get out of there, and I didn't really want to talk to them anyway. You know what? When Atiyah was around, it was Atiyah and Roger Martin running for the governorship, kind of on a wing and a prayer. And now we've got Ferrioli and McLean, and it's like, oh, it's like you guys aren't fucking doing anything.
Well, and
you know, in the old days, you would be saying, well, then let's step forward and do this. And it's just the culture has changed radically.
Right.
It's just amazing. That's what we're talking about. Packwood. One of the things I reeled him in on was, you know, Vic Atiyah is the last person who defeated a sitting governor. You defeated Wayne Morse. What the hell is that all about? And so, yeah, it was great. And his answer was great. It was, you know, he was an up-and-comer. He knew he wanted to try for something. He thought, if I don't embarrass myself by losing too badly to Morris,
will not
hurt. I'm going to set myself up in the future. And he wins by 3,000 votes.
Right.
And you know, that kind of thinking just isn't there.
Plus, Bob Packwood knew the tactical and operational aspects of a campaign.
Yeah. Yeah,
and Wayne Morris didn't care about campaign. He was just Wayne Morris.
Yeah,
know?
He was just Wayne Morris. Yeah, there's Wayne Morris meeting Bob Packwood for the first time. It's at the Pendleton Roundup, and the reporters know that Wayne Morris doesn't even really know who Bob Packwood is.
Right.
And the reporter said, "There he is, right over there." So Packwood walks over, and so it's all covered. You know, well, heard your name.
Oh, as long as we're getting in anecdotes that are beyond your book, I was at KSRV, KSRV Ontario, assistant news director. And I'll start with the end. Bob Packwood came to Malheur County first after he was elected because Malheur County gave him the greatest margin. And even Malheur County didn't give him that big of a margin. By the way, you have the Ernstein book. You have the list of every legislator all the way back to provisional days, of which there is, in fact, a more that I'm sure is an old relative of yours someplace along the line.
Yeah, ours came later.
Okay. Anyway, well, but you go back. They're all connected someplace, you know.
Yeah.
And so I remember that when he came back to Malheur County and made his first official visit as a senator-elect, I think, or maybe it was as a senator. But the only time that I met Wayne Morris was when he came to Malheur County to campaign. And his campaign in Malheur County was come to the airport, sit down, do interviews with the Argus Observer and KSRV and KYET from Payette, Idaho, and then get on an airplane and get the hell out of there kind of thing. And so I had a little, in those days, not even a cassette recorder. I had a little reel-to-reel recorder that had 15 minutes of tape on it if you ran it at normal speed kind of thing. And I set it down, and I'm just, you know, a snot-nosed kid, recent graduate of Oregon State kind of thing, and I don't know squat. And I sat down, and he said, okay, well, let me know when you got it set up. I'm like, okay, and I got it set up, and I hit it, and it's going in front of him, right? And I go, you know, Senator Morris, welcome to Malheur County. And that was the last word I said. Denny, it's really good to be here, and I got to tell you what I'm here for. And he just took off.
Yeah.
I'd never asked a single question. The interview went longer than 15 minutes, and I'm sitting there holding the microphone, and he's talking, and the tape is going. The tape is run out, and he can see the tape is run up, but he can't run off.
Yeah.
He can't stop.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, just unbelievable. Okay, back on point. You need to spend some time, obviously, talking to Jerry about the Rajneesh situation, and I know she's turned over to you a lot of stuff there. Just because I actually worked hard to not know the detail of what was going on so that I didn't have to be lying to the press was not something I did. And so I knew the big picture kind of thing, and you've heard the story about one reporter who said, you guys are blowing it,
yeah,
there's guns over there, and all this kind of stuff.
Especially in the chapter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, whatever. It amazes me how close that came to being just an incredible disaster. I mean, with military units, you know, quote, practicing or drilling in Clarno, to all of the weapons that they had and to the sickness that the core group had. And to me personally, just looking at it from the outside, it's a matter of the governor's commitment to the rights of the people in Antelope, the people in Wasco County, but also the people in Burgundy. I mean, the Rajneeshis themselves, because they were, the criminals were a relatively small group, and those people who really knew what was going on is a relatively small group.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's my understanding that Senator Kitzhaber and Stephanie Fowler, a reporter from Channel 8, mm-hmm. went over there and stayed overnight. And if they did, they were bugged.
Yeah, we got the tapes.
Okay, well, that's what I was wondering, whether or not those tapes...
I don't know. You know, Bob Oliver has this funny story about that, where Lon eventually comes in, because Bob and his wife went over.
Right, which he shouldn't have done.
No. But Lon comes in and says, God, you guys are bored. So...
Well, anyway, to me, the take-home message for me is different than what it would be for Jerry, because for Jerry it's going to be, this is how we did it, this is what the boss told me to do, here was the person who was really the person we dealt with, and KD was the one who, you know, was our source, and all that kind of tactical stuff. But to me it's the bigger picture thing of, he was as concerned about some formerly rich person who was there wearing an amulet around their neck as he was about the farmers of Antelope and everybody else. And that's very Atiyah.
Just read this paragraph and it'll flip to the next page.
Yeah, they were armored personnel carriers.
And just, scroll it up like that.
Yeah.
And then the tagline, which Jerry didn't even know, the feds paid for it.
Yeah. Well, they paid for it because and I'm surprised she didn't know, because I even knew that.
Uh-huh.
That was the whole idea, was that we were able to call it training, and we made it a federal government deal as a result of that, because the training was paid for by them.
Yeah.
So, and the only other connection I had was sitting with the governor in a Taiwan hotel room when the Bhagwan was making his run.
You guys were in Damascus.
Was it Damascus?
Yeah.
You're sure it wasn't Taiwan?
That's a 2-week trip. So you're hearing about the plans to arrest them and what the Bhagwan might or might not be doing, but then you guys are in Damascus when it...
That's a clarification,
because
I thought for sure it was Taiwan.
No. Big issues with Taiwan, the only, because of the recognition thing, the only country in the world where we didn't have a secure line. And so Jerry couldn't do her usual thing, which is go through the State Department and get a line and that kind of stuff.
Right,
which is in Damascus is where you guys are, where she's reporting as she hears things from the FAA. She's calling and saying, this is what's going on.
Right.
So you're in Damascus.
But they're still talking in code anyway.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Because this end, you aren't sure about ever.
Well, and I remember having a conversation with the, was it the Charzé or the ambassador from my hotel in Damascus, and he says, now you do understand how this telephone system works here in this fine country. And I said, yes, sir. I would say this to anyone that I'm about to... He said, good. I just wanted to make sure that you'd been fully briefed on this. The darn Damascus, the times of meeting with Assad, that's totally a sidebar to this thing, but I was amazed at how incompetent our CIA underlings were, the people who came in and who then debriefed us when we got back. They didn't know squat about what was going on. We knew more by reading National Geographic and Time magazine than they knew about what was going on.
Yeah.
And then the governor in his oral history and telling the story about Conatra, if that's how you pronounce it, that's how we were pronouncing it anyway, and then talking to Henry Kissinger and getting the stories. And the Henry Kissinger anecdote about, you know, the table will be round, and then the chair for Syria will be this, and for the Palestinians will be this, and so on, and the flags will be this tall, and you know, there'll be light coming in this window. Mr. President, is there anything I have not asked you that I should have asked you? Well, yes, you didn't ask me whether I was going to be there, and I'm not. Okay. Columbia Gorge Scenic Area, we talked about that later. Okay, I'm just going to read this. Milieu. Jim, this is your area. I'm about to describe things you already know. I do so not because you don't understand the milieu of 1977-87 period of time, but to make clear, from my perspective, I am asked by others in the IT administration. Their questions show a lack of real understanding about the differences in the overall environment during this time in office and how governors operate today. By comparison, we had a tiny staff. I think our staff was a third less than what Straub's staff was. I was paid half of what Michael Hartfield was being paid. I was being paid the going rate for a top flak, but I was, you know, they were just spending money like drunken sailors by comparison. The governor's office budget was cut from the Straub administration. Straub had, and we stopped, and now they're rampant, hiding governor's staff in agency budgets. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just expected now to do something like that, because they're reporting directly to an assistant to the governor or a deputy chief of staff. We didn't even have a deputy chief of staff, and yet they're in the Department of Human Resources budget someplace, and the head of the Department of Human Resources is simply housing them and paying for them, and that's that Ways and Means has to know that's going on. The ombudsman concept at its core is a government official who is beholden only to the chief executive, but who is able to hear complaints by citizens and so on and so forth. You know, that, what is it, a Scandinavian concept of some sort? And that whole concept is totally gone. These people are caseworkers. They're paid by the agency. They report to the agency. They're called ombudsmen. Mm-hmm. But it's not like somebody can go to an ombudsman and expect to be a whistleblower on something that's going on in that agency. I mean, and again, it's a whole different world than what was going on. The governor loved having an ombudsman because he would pick up on things that under no other circumstance. And so you got people like Jackie Winters, who are pretty savvy about state government. She can filter out the wackos from the potential real problems, and we can drill in on the problems. Well, what a wonderful tool. Current governors, and I don't think governors from our successor forward, really utilized that as should have been utilized. With near single or actual party, single party rule in Oregon government, in the years 87, people forget how a Republican governor has to operate with a Democratic majority in both houses. The boss was well suited for that role. We were fortunate. We only had a couple of House and Senate leaders, Cairns and Fadley, who were maliciously partisan. But still, it was Atiyah's extensive legislative experience, the effective use of vetoes and veto threats, and bless crazy Larry Campbell, who was, you know, sometimes hard to get along with as a person, personality similar to mine, who basically held together that caucus on vetoes. You know, if you want to be able to threaten a veto down the road, then you got to uphold a veto that you don't want to uphold. Mm-hmm. And that saved our buns on several situations. That the recession was, in fact, worse than it was in this most recent Great Recession. Media are a shadow of themselves. The governor now has, as the governor should have, a multi-person crack security team, motorcades, front cars, back cars, lead people, advance people going up and things like that, rotations so that they're actually working reasonable shifts. We had lawn. Mm-hmm. And it was only late in the administration that Darrell came in for some relief. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was just insane. But again, how do you go out and when they're calling a Buick Skylark a sleek, black, long limousine, you know, if you're going to add security people when no governor before has had more. And we found out recently that the state police in many ways kind of thought that was a dead-end position, that they didn't really put that good of a person in there. Well, of course, Lon turns out to be an incredible person. Mm-hmm. I'm really biased in terms of that. Paying rent on the Winter Street mansion. You know, that's just, again, insane. People don't realize now with Mahoney Hall, and you know, Jerry Frank went on Mahoney Hall. Yeah. You've heard that story. Yeah. Okay. When we entertained legislators, and we was assumed that about 70 would show up, we had to do it in like three shifts because the living room was just about as big as this room we're in right now. I purchased one of the first personal computers associated in some way with the man named Atiyah. It was a floppy drive IBM PC for the 1982 campaign, which was basically a word processor and a very rudimentary database manager. in the office. I think we had two MEG card word processors. So the card had the form letter on it, and you'd slide it in, and they were in a big cabinet. Mm-hmm. And so, again, today people are working with things this big that have 400,000 times the computing power mm-hmm. of a simple little word processor. You knew that the person was an important and influential staff person because they had their own IBM, quote, self-correcting, meaning you push the button right up here and it would put up the tape. And that was like the creme de creme kind of thing. No email, no cell phones, no internet, no social media. The only person to have an expensive to purchase and pay for by the minute car phone was the chief of staff. Mm-hmm. The governor had a state police radio, 95-95. The chief of staff eventually got a radio, and her call was 95-90. Mm-hmm. But you don't really have routine communication using a state police radio. Late in the process, they installed a state police radio in Dolores' car. Have you heard about this?
No.
It had a very odd problem. Every time you keyed the mic, the windshield wiper did a cycle.
That's great.
I think they fixed it eventually, and they never really used it a whole lot. But they did install a radio in the car that she used because she was out doing state business and things like that.
Yeah.
It was so hilarious. I mean, you literally wanted to call on the radio just to check in
great.
When you were with her just to watch the windshield wiper go.
That's great.
Everybody smoked. It was like Mad Men only in politics.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just kind of the surface.
Yeah.
The fact is that when, first of all, nobody knows who Governor Attia is because you're talking to somebody who's younger than I am. If you're talking to them and they haven't been in the state that long and they don't remember and so on and so forth, and so they don't know how special that whole time was. They don't, and we've not had a situation where we've had a completely Republican legislature with a Democratic governor, and so nobody understands. You know, one party rule is getting to be like, oh yeah, that's the way government runs.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know this for a fact, but I would allege that right now in the civil service system, the Democratic patronage has dropped down to about the 10th level in state government.
Mm-hmm. Very easily, yeah.
And that if anybody were to look at registration figures and compare them with the registration averages in Marion County and Polk County, that you would find that state government's being run at the very lowest levels by Democratic patrons who are not patrons, by those who they patronized.
Mm-hmm.
And because there was a time when I thought about ending consult, well, I